log off.
I won't throw the flowers then.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV licence covers you to watch all TV channels, plus BBC iPlayer, full of life-enhancing arts and culture coverage. It also funds everything you love from the BBC, including Radio 4. Search TV licence together.
Good morning, it is 6 o'clock. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Glasgow and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning. The headlines today. The former NATO Secretary General and author of the government's Strategic Defence Review, Lord Robertson, has accused ministers of corrosive complacency on defence, warning the UK's safety is in peril. And the American Vice President, J.D. Vance, says there was progress with Iran during talks at the weekend, but has described the country's closure of the Strait of Hormuz as an act of economic terrorism.
They basically threatened any ship that's moving through the Straits of Hormuz. Well, as the President of the United States showed, two can play at that game.
We'll get the latest on shipping there from the head of the UN's Maritime Agency.
Also in today's programme, how do we ensure an attack like the one in Southport 2 years ago never happens again? We'll be hearing from the lawyer representing the families of the three young girls who were murdered. With elections to the Scottish Parliament just over 3 weeks away, what do voters make of the campaign so far?
For working class families, we're in a worse position than we've ever been, so there's nobody fighting our corner here.
It feels that way.
It feels that way, absolutely, yeah.
They talk as if they're trying to help you.
Yeah. No, you just don't see it.
We're joined by Scotland's First Minister and the leader of Scottish Labour. And a new book encourages us to discover the beauty and the wonder of the sky above our heads. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
A former Labour cabinet minister who last year carried out a major review of the UK's armed forces has mounted a scathing attack on the government's handling of defence. Lord Robertson, who served as NATO Secretary General, will use a speech to warn of a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Lord Robertson oversaw Labour's comprehensive review of defence policy that was published last year. But the investment plan to fund that vision has since been repeatedly delayed. Now, in a significant intervention, Lord Robertson will accuse what he calls non-military experts in the Treasury of vandalism. We are underprepared. We are underinsured. We are under attack. We are not safe, he will say in a speech today. Britain's national security and safety is in peril. There has been deadlock in government over the defence investment plan. The Prime Minister has said it is on his desk and he will resolve the matter. Lord Robertson will say, we cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget. A government spokesperson said the Strategic Defence Review was backed by the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War, and the investment plan would be published as soon as possible.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused the Iranian government of engaging in an act of economic terrorism by stopping ships from using the Strait of Hormuz. Speaking to Fox News, he said President Trump had shown that two could play at that game. Yesterday, the US began its own blockade of Iranian ports. Mr. Vance, who led the negotiation team during talks with Iran at the weekend, said there had been progress despite the failure to reach an agreement. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
J.D. Vance said if the Iranians engaged in economic terrorism over the Strait of Hormuz, the US would abide by the same principle and make sure none of the country's ships got out of Iran either. He accused Tehran of moving the goalposts during talks at the weekend, saying that he'd expected the Iranians to fully reopen the strait in return for a ceasefire. He insisted that both sides had made some progress in the negotiation, but that it was now up to Iran to make the next move. The ball, he said, was very much in their court.
Talks between Lebanese and Israeli ambassadors to the US are expected to take place in Washington later. It will be the first time in decades that officials from the two countries, which don't have diplomatic relations, meet face-to-face for direct negotiations. Attacks in Lebanon have continued despite last week's ceasefire between the US and Iran. The BBC understands that the police watchdog, the IOPC, is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force over its response to a fatal crash at a South London school in 2023. Two children, Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau, who were both eight, died after a Land Rover hit an end-of-term tea party at the Study Preparatory School in Wimbledon. The children's parents said they were encouraged by the latest development, but still wanted the truth about their daughters' deaths. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
When the police carried out its first investigation into the Wimbledon school crash, it ended with the driver, Claire Fremantle, facing no charges, as prosecutors said she'd had an undiagnosed epileptic seizure. The victim's parents always said the investigation was flawed, and it was reopened in 2024. The police watchdog will examine the way it was carried out, including allegations that race was a factor in the way officers treated the girls' families and if the police gave false information to them. Four serving police officers, including a commander and a former officer, are being investigated for possible gross misconduct. The Metropolitan Police said it would provide every assistance to the police watchdog.
The US Vice President, J.D. Vance, has called on the Vatican to stick to matters of morality after Donald Trump heavily criticised the Pope. Mr. Trump refused to apologise for calling Leo XIV weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. The Pope had condemned the war against Iran. Mr. Trump has also faced criticism for a now-deleted social media post which depicted the president as a Jesus-like figure. Donald Trump claimed it was meant to be him as a doctor. The English Cardinal Timothy Radcliffe, who took part in the conclave that elected the Pope, told Newsnight he was right to challenge Mr. Trump's actions.
For the first time for a long time, the great powers of the world openly seek to seize power nakedly by violence. I think that the Pope has a duty to speak out against anybody who promotes war in this way.
There's a warning that girls from white, low-income families are being overlooked in efforts to tackle the underachievement of working-class children in England. School leaders are calling for targeted action to address a sharp decline in GCSE results among white girls from disadvantaged backgrounds. This student in Hull explains why she feels disillusioned with school.
I think because everyone is surrounded by people who maybe didn't go to university, maybe don't have the most respectable jobs, I think it kind of just puts it in their heads that that's just going to be me, so why should I try? A lot of girls have this idea where they just think that's going to be me anyway, so I don't really see a point in trying.
The Department for Education said it was radically reforming the way funding for disadvantaged groups is given to schools to make sure the system is better for children. A record six British artists are to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in November. They are Oasis, Phil Collins, Sade, Billy Idol and Iron Maiden, together with Joy Division and New Order, who are being treated as one group.
Thank you, Jane. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's see what the weather looks like today with Elizabeth Rizzini. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna. Well, it's still unsettled for the rest of the week. There'll be some showers and longer spells of rain, but there'll also be some brightness and some sunshine. It will tend to be drier towards eastern areas too. And temperatures will be around or above the seasonal average. It will be turning a bit warmer. So a fairly different day from yesterday when we saw some sunshine and some heavy thundery showers. Today, though, it's another chilly start to the day. For central and eastern areas, there's a touch of frost out there across Scotland, the Midlands, low single figures for many, but towards western spots, 10 degrees Celsius in the far southwest of England currently, and 7 or 8 across Northern Ireland. It's cloudier and milder in the west. There'll be patchy light rain and drizzle, some hill fog as well. That's an Atlantic front approaching. It's going to be pushing further eastwards and will be showing its hand everywhere by the time we get into the afternoon. So for Northern Ireland, Wales, southwest England, little change throughout the day. Cloud, patchy rain and drizzle, really very overcast, and fresh to locally strong southerly to southeasterly winds. For central and western Scotland, for much of England, a bright early start, but it will be quickly clouding over. For southeast England and northern eastern Scotland, I think we'll keep that sunshine for much of the day. So bright skies even into the afternoon, and it's a bit warmer than it was yesterday too. That southerly wind, 11 to 15 degrees Celsius for most, but 10 degrees Celsius in northern and western Scotland, and a bit warmer still, 17 degrees in central and eastern England. And of course, it will be milder with more weather fronts tonight.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. 6:09. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The damning verdict of the Southport inquiry is the lead for the Mail, the Express, the Sun and the Mirror. They didn't have to die is the Sun's headline after the report found the murders of B.B. King, Elsie Dot Stankham and Alice De Silva Aguiar would not have happened if the killer's parents had intervened. The Mirror says the parents of the three young victims have vowed to carry on the fight for change.
The comments by Lord Robertson, the former NATO Secretary General, that Britain's leaders have shown a corrosive complacency towards defence, are the lead in the Financial Times this morning. The paper describes them as a stinging rebuke of the Prime Minister's defence policy.
The Times reports that households are going to be offered free electricity to do their laundry on sunny weekends. It's part of the measures to help prevent the UK's power grid being swamped with surplus solar energy this summer. It says the National Energy System Operator will announce a scheme today to reward customers for using electricity at times when there is oversupply.
If you're someone who avoids small talk because you find it boring, then new research reported in The Guardian today might perhaps encourage you to think again. Academics at the University of Michigan ran a series of experiments to see how people responded to the prospect of a conversation on a topic that they personally considered dull. Everything from the stock markets and vegan diets to Pokemon and onions, bizarrely. The paper says that people consistently found the conversations more interesting than they had predicted, leading one of the researchers to conclude that a sense of connection rather than the topic of conversation was the most important thing.
So good we have researchers to work these things out. President Trump's deleted AI image, which appeared to depict him as Jesus Christ, I think there were plenty of conversations about that yesterday, is on many of the paper's front pages. Mr. Trump claimed he thought he looked like a doctor in the image, where he has his hand on the forehead of a sick man. The Daily Star looks to Monty Python for its headline. You're not the Messiah. You're a very naughty boy, it reads. And of course, Anna, it was all the fault of the fake news media.
Always is. I think you'll find it's 6:11 now.
I should just tell you, because I'm broadcasting from Glasgow this morning, that on the front page of the Scottish papers today, there is not that much about politics, which is interesting given that the Labour Party launched its manifesto yesterday. Anna Sawa does shine out from the front page of the Herald holding up his manifesto. We'll be hearing from him later on, but it is other news that makes most of the front pages here in Scotland. Although the National, a critic of the Labour Party, has the headline, Labour Indy Rep refusal is a sign of fear. Let's turn to other news now. 11 Metropolitan Police officers are being investigated after allegations that they failed to properly investigate a crash at a Wimbledon school which killed 2 8-year-olds. Following that story for us, the BBC special correspondent Lucy Manning. Tell us more, Lucy.
Hi, Nick. Well, this all goes back to 2023 and a horrific crash on the last day of term at the study prep school in Wimbledon. The girls and their parents were out on the school lawn celebrating that end of term when a Land Rover crashed through the school railings into them, and 2 8-year-olds, Selina Lau and Nuria Sajjad, were killed. And when the Met Police carried out its first investigation, it ended with the driver, Claire Fremantle, facing no charges. Prosecutors said she had had an undiagnosed seizure, and when the charges were dropped, she expressed deepest sorrow but said she had no recollection of what happened. And the parents of Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau always said the investigation was flawed, and it was reopened a year later, and now the police watchdog are investigating that first investigation.
Lucy Manning, thank you.
It is 6:13. Now, the US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused Iran of terrorising the global economy through its blockade of shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. This is what he had to say on Fox News' special report with Brett Baier last night.
What they have done is engage in this act of economic terrorism against the entire world. They basically threatened any ship that's moving through the Straits of Hormuz. Well, as the President of the United States showed, two can play at that game. And if the Iranians are going to try to engage in economic terrorism, we're going to abide by a simple principle that no Iranian ships are getting out either.
Well, our North America correspondent Peter Bowes told me more about the vice president's position.
In this interview, he talked in much more detail and addressed some of the issues that we didn't hear about when the talks broke up in the early hours of Sunday, namely the Strait of Hormuz, which we've just been hearing. In fact, the vice president went as far as to accuse Tehran of moving the goalposts during that meeting, saying that he'd expected the Iranians to fully reopen the strait in return for a ceasefire. He said that by blocking traffic, Iran was engaging in an act of economic terrorism, and that were that to continue, the US would abide by the same principle that no Iranian ships would get out either. He said two could play at that game. So, as we know, the US blockade of Iran's ports is now in effect. Donald Trump has said that more ships are getting through, but I think this issue remains the most sensitive. It certainly will be for the coming days, as long as global trade is being hampered in the way that it has been in recent weeks. And it seems highly unlikely that until this issue of the strait is resolved, the other very big issues are not even going to be discussed.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about them, Peter, because he touched on those as well, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He talked about these really core issues that are dividing the two countries. He said Washington had put a lot on the table, but that it was now up to Iran to make the next move. On the table, he said, was the ceasefire and the promise that Iran could one day be treated like a normal country, as he put it. He said if it was a normal country, people would be able to prosper and thrive. But in order for Iran to be a normal country, it could never get a nuclear weapon. He said we must have the enriched material out of Iran. We must have their conclusive commitment not to develop a nuclear weapon. The same issues that we've been hearing about for months now. That, he said, would be a very, very good deal for both countries. And he also repeated his and the president's view that both sides had made some progress during the negotiations at the weekend, but that it was now up to Iran to make the next move. The ball, he said, was very much in their court.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
16 minutes past six now. The crisis in the Middle East is proving to be an education for all of us about what we get that is derived from oil, not just petrol, of course, and what it is that powers our homes, but also textiles. Many synthetics are derived from oil, and clothing suppliers are warning this morning that the prices will go up. Sean can tell us more.
Yes. Hi, Nick. So we've already had, you know, one of Uniqlo's main suppliers say that polyester fibre and the prices of those will rise by 20%. The fashion retail magazine Drapers reporting that suppliers from the UK to China have said their raw materials are rising. And it is fabrics like polyester, nylon, acrylic, all derived from oil. They're widely used in sportswear as well, from football kits to gym gear, which, of course, is a key focus of Tom Behan, who is the co-founder and co-chief executive of the sportswear company Castor. So that makes kits for Premier League football clubs, England cricket and beyond. Tom, good morning. Have you seen prices impacted?
Morning, Sean. Yes, it's certainly been a challenging period, I think, for all brands. Anyone that manufactures products that, as you said, do use polyester and synthetic fabrics that incorporate oil. I think the biggest challenge has been around the volatility. So it's very difficult to plan when prices might be going up as high as 40% one day, but then dropping down significantly again the next day. On average, we're seeing prices go up in double digits, so somewhere between 10 and 15%. But the other challenge that maybe hasn't been spoken about as much is on the constraint side of things with regards to capacity. So most worryingly, we are starting to see some airline carriers, cargo freight companies reduce the amount of flights that they're doing or the amount of ships that are obviously passing through the strait so product physically can't get to its destination. That is something that is causing a lot of concern, but it does change on an almost daily basis. So challenging times, but there is a hope that if things start to get sorted out in the next few weeks, they won't have a significant impact on customers, certainly more than it already has done.
How long do you think it needs to go on for it to start having an impact on customers? Because we've heard a lot about the hope, but actually, you know, we're getting to a point where surely it's going to start having an impact.
Sure. Probably longer than most people think is the honest answer. Remember, most supply chains are 12 months plus in terms of their manufacturing cycle. So certainly in the sportswear market, there might be differences in fast fashion where things are coming in on a kind of daily basis. But certainly in the sportswear market, these things are well embedded. Plans are in place. There's the opportunity to flex around plans and shift manufacturing from maybe the Far East to slightly nearer shore destinations. That's all challenging for business, but it is achievable. Certainly if the conflict drags on and the Strait of Hormuz is either closed or certainly not fully open within the next, I would say, 4, 6, 8 weeks, that will cause real serious headaches. But it is worth repeating that there are changes that business can make to manage around it.
What about around costs? Are you inevitably going to have to pass on some of those price rises?
We hope not. Again, there are mitigating changes that can be made. You can work with your suppliers. You can work with partners throughout the supply chain. I think everyone's aware that technology and AI in particular is becoming more embedded within businesses. I do think that there will be an unexpected consequence of this conflict and crisis. Those changes will maybe be accelerated. We're certainly doing that at Castor. We're looking at any area that we can embed AI and technology more quickly, more deeply into the business to cut out costs, to become more efficient, to become more data-led. That will hopefully help things. But again, if the conflict carries on, certainly for a couple of months, it's inevitable that at some point that will flow through to the customer.
What's been the biggest consequence in how you run your business, Tom, given the COVID shock, the energy price shock of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, now this? Do you reflect on Castor now as making things in a different way, in different places, different customers because of these big shocks?
So Castor has a global supply chain. We have global manufacturing partners, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, China, India, Bangladesh. But we also do work more closely to the UK. So Turkey, parts of Eastern Europe, countries like Lithuania. It's been very much a case of how do we manage the business in a more agile way. I do see, and I think British businesses are maybe at an advantage. We're not great in this country at kind of being optimistic or talking up the positives. But one of the advantages I see of being a British business rather than a US business and maybe a challenger brand, a fast growth company as opposed to a status quo incumbent company, is that ability to be more agile, whether it's changing where you manufacture products or, as I referenced earlier, implementing AI and technology into your business. You can make those decisions more quickly. They are genuine competitive advantages. So that is how we're seeing things at the moment.
Are you manufacturing closer to home than you were?
Yes, absolutely. So again, the challenge is a lot of other people are trying to do that as well. So if all of the manufacturing shifts in a short space of time, there are kind of capacity constraints, but there's also price increases. So we are seeing that happen. Yes, manufacturing closer. And that is something that I expect to continue.
Just briefly, Tom, and you've got part of your business in the Middle East itself. What impacts have you seen there?
There's been significant reductions in footfall in Dubai. So people going to malls, we've seen significant drop-offs. Again, the key word I would use, though, is that this is changing very quickly. So week to week, you'll get big shifts, 40% reduction in footfall or revenue in a store, but then it will bounce back very quickly. So it's not a continuous linear change.
Right.
This is moving very quickly.
Tom, thank you for your time. Tom Behan there, co-founder and co-chief executive at Castor. On similar lines to that, retailers in the Middle East across the United Arab Emirates, we've seen have had that footfall drop, particularly through March, thousands of international residents and tourists leaving the country. And Natasha Sidaris is founder of Tasha's Hospitality Group, got 14 bars and restaurants across the UAE, 1,000 people employed as well. Natasha, morning. What have been the biggest consequences for your businesses?
Morning. Thanks for having me on. So, you know, as you said, directly in the beginning of the war, we also had Ramadan. So I think that initial shock factor combined with Ramadan had a dramatic decrease in our numbers in the first few weeks. But because Dubai does have a community and it's a living community, and it's almost doubled to 4 million residents over the last 10 years. So we are seeing some stability returning. And the strength of that community is really evident because we were down 50% in some of our venues, 70 to 80% down in other venues. And the situation is now a little bit more manageable. We are between 25 to 30% down overall decline. And we've taken some steps right at the beginning to really try and combat the impact, reduced our menus. You know, you're talking about supply chain earlier, reduced our menus to try and take pressure off the supply chain. We took a vote amongst all of the staff, over 1,200 people, and said, do we have to retrench or make redundant 30% of the team, or do we all take a haircut as we did in COVID? And it was a resounding support of rather everyone taking a haircut just to show the camaraderie.
And is that something that's multiplied across? You know, are you seeing that sort of action with staff and their salaries across Dubai, for example?
I think a lot of people are using different approaches. So some are asking staff to go on unpaid leave. Some are definitely retrenching. Some are closing some venues and only going to reopen after the season, you know, maybe in September, October. We're very lucky. We have a couple of brands. So Tasha's is our main brand. We have one in the Battersea Power Station, very much community-based. So that's been less affected. And then, of course, we have Elevated Dining and Bars, and those have been more affected, and I think for a couple of reasons. I think people are watching their spending. And the other reason is because those venues are in the more touristic areas, you know, in the hotels that have been hit a lot harder.
And is that where you see the, you know, the rebound question being tougher, the tourism, rather than maybe what is seen as the domestic economy?
Yeah, definitely that's going to be the tougher one to recover. But I think with the way the world works today, we've all got short memories. I think the way that Dubai has handled both COVID and this, or rather the UAE has handled COVID and now the war. You know, we've had 3,000 projectiles fired at us since the war began. And I don't know of many other cities that would be able to keep its residents safe and still keep the wheels turning.
No, but at the same time, not many other cities will now have to make that pitch to tourists in a new environment.
Exactly. But I think Dubai's, you know, I think it's come back from a lot. And I think this will be another one of those comeback stories. I really am confident. I've been a UAE resident for the last 11 years. And whether we see that comeback in October, November, or whether we see it in Q1 next year, we will see a comeback.
Natasha.
And it will be gradual, but I think it will come back.
Natasha Sidaris, founder of Tasha's Hospitality Group with those bars and restaurants across the UAE. Thank you for your time. Jane Sydenham is Investment Director at Rathbones. Jane, just on the oil price this morning, down a little bit, but why is that?
Yeah, down a little bit. Asian stock markets up a little bit. Really expectations of an end to the conflict reasonably soon, whether or not the blockade might increase pressure on China, perhaps to pressure Iran. Markets are certainly thinking it's going to come to an end soon, even though the physical short day, you know, the spot prices, today's prices are quite high in certain places.
Jane, a question I've had from a fair few people in the last few weeks has been, you know, which places are appearing to do well out of the what is going on in the Middle East at the minute? Not deliberately, of course, but when we see you see Goldman Sachs profits jumping in their best quarter for 5 years, why that performance?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is the investment banking division of Goldman Sachs has been very strong. Their equity trading has been very strong. Traders can make money in markets even if the general direction is downward. Having said that, their bond trading division hasn't been doing quite so well. But overall, you know, a reasonably good result for sure.
Jane, thank you. Jane Sydenham there from Rathbones. I'll be back after 7 o'clock.
Lovely. Thank you, Sean. 28 minutes past six now. Time for the sport. Here's Carthy. Morning.
Morning. Thank you very much. A massive result for Leeds United last night. A 2-1 win over Manchester United in the Premier League. Leeds are 6 points clear of the relegation zone now, but it was a first home defeat for Michael Carrick, as Mike Mine reports from Old Trafford.
Leeds United, Manchester United's bitter Yorkshire rivals, played the game with organisation and adventure. Two first half low volleys from Noah Okafor had Leeds two up at the break. Matters were made worse in the second half for the Reds when Lisandro Martinez pulled the hair of Dominic Calvert-Lewin and was sent off following a VAR review. Casemiro's header halved the deficit, but both sides denied chances of the fourth goal with on-the-line blocks. Leeds United now 6 points clear of the relegation zone with a first win at Old Trafford since 1981.
Arne Slot insists his Liverpool side still believe they can do something special against Paris Saint-Germain in the return leg of their Champions League quarter-final tonight, despite PSG having a two-goal advantage from the first leg.
Of course, we know we need an exceptional performance, but that's completely normal if you face the champions of Europe and you're 2-0 down. But then, we've also been able to score once in a while more than two goals. But let's first focus on the job at hand, and that is just start aggressive, making sure we can get back into the tie. And the best way of doing so is, of course, scoring the first goal.
Well, commentary on 5 Live from 8pm of that match. England women face World Cup champion Spain tonight in a World Cup qualifier. Scotland host Belgium. Wales face Albania. Northern Ireland host Malta. British tennis number one, Cam Norrie, beat Stan Wawrinka in three sets at the Barcelona Open to reach the second round yesterday. But Jack Draper had to retire during his first round match because of a knee injury. And the triple Olympic champion Adam Peaty returns to competitive swimming at the British Championships today after a year out following the Paris Olympics. Peaty is aiming for the 2028 LA Olympics, but admits he finds it more difficult to motivate himself for other events.
If I get there, which I think I will, that'll be my fourth Olympic Games. And when you've done four Olympic Games, unfortunately, the rest of them don't really have the same taste as the Olympics. It's like you're tasting, you know, the most amazing steak, and then you have to go back to, you know, a McDonald's burger, I guess. The Olympics are the one that excites me. The Olympics is the tomahawk for me. So that is the one that really, really gets me out of bed.
A little bit early, perhaps, for steak chat. But that's your sport.
And I'm thinking it.
Thank you, Kelsey. It is 6:30 now. There is wartime drama coming up on Radio 4 this week.
We can't just come clean, can we?
But the paperwork. Think of the paperwork.
Brand new drama starring Toby Jones, based on Kate Atkinson's best-selling thriller.
Seven words scrawled in terrible handwriting. You will pay for what you did.
Wartime espionage with post-war repercussions.
Do you think I should be worried?
Well, that depends what you did.
She's betrayed us.
You haven't betrayed us, have you?
I'll kill you! I'll kill you!
Transcription starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday afternoon at 3.
It is 29 minutes to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Glasgow and Anna Foster in Salford. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
A former Labour cabinet minister who last year carried out a root and branch review of the armed forces has mounted a scathing attack on the government's handling of defence. Lord Robertson, who also served as NATO Secretary General, will warn in a speech of a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. There's been deadlock in government over its defence investment plan, although the Prime Minister has said he will resolve the matter. Ministers insist they've carried out the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused the Iranian government of engaging in an act of economic terrorism by stopping ships from using the Strait of Hormuz. Yesterday, the US began its own blockade of Iranian ports. Talks between Lebanese and Israeli ambassadors to the US are expected to take place in Washington later. It will be the first time in decades that officials from the two countries, which don't have diplomatic relations, meet face-to-face for direct negotiations. The BBC understands that the police watchdog, the IOPC, is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force over its response to a fatal crash at a South London school in 2023. Two children, Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau, who were both 8, died after a Land Rover hit an end-of-term tea party at the Study Preparatory School in Wimbledon. 4 serving police officers and a former officer are being investigated for possible gross misconduct. There's a warning that girls from white, low-income families are being overlooked in efforts to tackle the underachievement of working-class children in England. GCSE data shows results for the group have seen one of the biggest declines since 2019. The Department for Education said it was radically reforming the way funding for disadvantaged groups is given to schools. A record 6 British artists are to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame later this year. Oasis, Phil Collins and Iron Maiden are among those being recognised by the American institution.
Thank you, Jane. It's 27 minutes to 7 now. We are not safe, and the Treasury are in part to blame. That's the stark warning being issued today by the man chosen by the Prime Minister to write the Strategic Defence Review, the former NATO Secretary-General, Lord Robertson. We're joined by our Chief Political Correspondent, Henry Zeffman. Morning, Henry. He believes the government should have published its plans to spend more on defence, does he?
That's right, Nick. I mean, this doesn't feel so much like mere constructive criticism as an explosion of frustration, and from a rather unexpected quarter as far as the government will be concerned, given that George Robertson is a Labour former defence secretary who was picked by this government to lead their strategic defence review, which was published last year. As you say, a particular target of his ire is the Treasury. According to the extracts of this speech he'll be giving today, which are carried in the Financial Times, he talks of non-military experts in the Treasury being guilty of vandalism. He more broadly talks about corrosive complacency from Britain's political leadership. But yes, as you say, he is also frustrated by the absence of the government's defence investment plan, a 10-year defence investment plan, which was due last autumn. And it was meant to describe how the government would meet the recommendations of Lord Robertson's Strategic Defence Review, which they accepted in full. There appear to be disagreements in government about how to fund it, indeed how to fund existing defence spending plans. I mean, Lord Robertson's answer in his speech is this. He says, we cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget. Of course, actually, Rachel Reeves is quite sympathetic to that, but as we learnt last year, Labour MPs somewhat less so.
The bigger picture here is that there are disagreements in government about how to fund anything, isn't there, as a result of the war exploding everybody's economic plans.
I think that's right. And I think the government still, if you speak to senior people, do not quite know how serious, how long-lasting the economic impact of this particular iteration of the conflict in the Middle East is going to be. They do, though, believe that it is going to be long-lasting in some form. One thing I've learned is that the Prime Minister has decided, rather than having ad hoc cobras, which we've talked about over the past few weeks, to set up a semi-permanent cabinet committee to discuss the fallout from the war in Iran. It's going to be called the Middle East Response Committee. The Prime Minister is chairing its first meeting today, and it will, in particular, as well as the diplomatic side of things, look at the economic fallout here in the UK. It's quite unusual, this. I think the best parallels I can think of are when the governments under Boris Johnson set up cabinet committees that met regularly to discuss COVID, and also the period where a no-deal Brexit seemed plausible. But I think this is the government saying internally and in how it structures itself that the fallout from this war is going to dominate and dominate for some time.
Fascinating insight into the depth of the potential impact of the war for all of us for a long time to come. Henry Zeffman, thanks.
It's 24 minutes to 7 now. There'll be direct talks later in Washington, D.C. about trying to reach a new ceasefire in Lebanon. Discussions like this are vanishingly rare, but they're only happening, it's worth mentioning, at ambassadorial level rather than between governments themselves, which does leave questions about how much can realistically be achieved. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent. Also crucial, Yolande, that Hezbollah at the centre of this have already rejected those talks.
That's right, Anna. So you have, on the one hand, two countries that have technically been at war for decades, meeting. It's the most high-level direct meeting since 1993 between Israel and Lebanon. So in that sense, it's positive that the meeting is taking place at all. For many Lebanese especially, this is really breaking some kind of taboo. The problem is that Beirut, first of all, wants to secure a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. And Israel has just dismissed that out of hand for now. It's insisting that Hezbollah must be disarmed. Hezbollah, of course, a political player in Lebanon, an armed group backed by Iran. And, you know, the goal of Israel, it says in these talks, is to focus on moving towards formal peace talks with the Lebanese government itself. Now, the Hezbollah leader, Naim Qassem, has, as you said, rejected these talks out of hand. hand. He just wants the meeting cancelled. And he's promised that Hezbollah will fight until our last breath. There was a march on Saturday by Hezbollah supporters and others against this meeting in Lebanon. And for many Lebanese, the fear is that there could be this sort of like divide pushed and there could be a renewal of internal conflict in Lebanon as a country which have already gone through a bloody civil war, of course, between 1975 and 1990.
And Israel in particular, Yoland, has been very insistent that when, for example, a ceasefire is called with Iran to have talks, that Lebanon is not part of that. Israel treating the war in Lebanon very much as a separate entity to the war in Iran.
That's right. Although they're very much related, you know, there was confusion, of course, over whether Lebanon was included in the ceasefire with Iran last week with Israel and then, you know, backed up by the US saying that it wasn't. And then, you know, what we have had since then is this indication that under pressure, Israel sort of agreed to de-escalate the fighting with Hezbollah and then agreed to these ambassadorial talks. Now, you know, really, although things have been scaled down, they have not stopped in Lebanon from all the signs we've seen. The ground offensive in particular has continued in the town of Bint Jabil, a Hezbollah stronghold in southern Lebanon.
Yolande, thank you. Yolande Nell there, our Middle East correspondent.
It is 21 minutes to 7 now. Nigel Farage set his sights on taking outright power in Scotland when he spoke at a rally in Aberdeen last night. Not at this election, but at the next one. His goal when Scots go to the polls next month is for his Reform UK party to come second. The man who the polls currently put in first place, the SNP's John Swinney, who we'll hear from in the next hour of the programme, says Farage's views should have no place in Scotland. What that row really reveals is that the politics of this country, I'm broadcasting from Glasgow this morning, is changing and changing fast. The man who knows much more about that, though, joins us now, Professor Sir John Curtis, Professor of Politics at Strathclyde University. Morning to you, John. Let's take a trot through some of these big players in this poll, beginning with Mr. Farage. He's fond of making big, bold claims, but he is changing politics here, isn't he?
Yes, though not necessarily in a way that he would particularly want to acknowledge. The polling has been suggesting for quite a while that there is indeed a battle going on between Reform and Labour for second place, though some, though not all, of the more recent Scottish polling suggest that maybe Reform have slipped back a bit, much as they have done in the British-wide polling during March. But the real and that will, you know, at around 16% or so, according to the polls, Reform, given the at least some of the seats in Scotland are elected by proportional representation, that they will be in the new parliament. That said, however, the principal impact of Reform's rise in Scotland has been to fragment further the unionist vote, that support for Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democrat parties, but particularly having an impact on Labour in Scotland. And that it is that that's helped to ensure that although the SNP is not that much more popular than it was at the time of the 2024 election, when they lost a lot of seats to Labour, the SNP now enjoy a commanding lead, seemingly, over every other single party, with the Labour Party down to below 20%, much as they are in the British-wide polls.
Now, nobody's voted, and they are trying to turn that round. The Labour Party launched its manifesto yesterday. We're going to hear from their leader later in the programme. What is it that has held Labour in Scotland back? Is it anything happening here, or is it all about what's been happening in Westminster?
It's what's happening at Westminster, Nick. The problem that Labour have in Scotland is that even those people who voted for the party in 2024, ask them how good or bad a job they think the UK government is doing, ask them whether or not they trust Labour to make the right decisions on the crucial issues of the economy and health, they, on balance, give Labour a negative evaluation. Now, of course, Anas Sawa's response to that has been, look, this is not an election about what's going on at Westminster, it's an election about what's going on at Holyrood, and has been criticising the SNP's record in government. However, the other problem he now has is that although Scots in general would give the Scottish SNP government a negative evaluation on the same kind of questions, at least the admittedly much diminished number of people who are minded to vote for the SNP again this year, that is much diminished as compared with 2021 when the SNP got nearly half the vote, that group evaluates the Scottish government positively. So in trying to attack the record of the SNP government and win voters over from the SNP in that way, the problem he faces is he's talking to a group of people who don't think that the Scottish government are doing badly.
Professor Sir John Curtis, thank you very much indeed. We'll hear from the leader of the Scottish Lib Dems in a few minutes' time. And if you weren't listening yesterday, we did hear then from the leader of Reform in Scotland, the Scottish Greens and the Scottish Conservatives.
17 minutes to 7 now. It was the first day back at Westminster for MPs yesterday after the Easter break, and it was dominated by events in the Middle East, the impact it's having both at home and abroad. Our parliamentary correspondent Susan Hume reports on the Prime Minister's House of Commons statement.
It's often said that the Prime Minister's first duty is to keep the country safe, but it seems that doesn't stretch to reassuring our jangled nerves that everything is safe.
The world in which we live has utterly changed. It is more volatile and insecure than at any period in my lifetime. And we must rise to meet it, calmly but with strength.
Half an hour before Sir Keir Starmer stood up in the Commons, the US had begun its naval blockade of Iran's ports. The Prime Minister said the UK would not take part in that. Instead, Britain would host a summit with France to find a diplomatic end to the conflict and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, agreed the world had become more dangerous, so it really was time the UK spent more on defence, and she'd be happy to help.
The government has a plan for welfare spending until 2031, but no plans for defence spending. So I say to the Prime Minister, let's put party interest aside. Yes. I'm glad that they're laughing, because I want the public to hear Labour MPs laughing when we say let's put party interest aside. So please keep laughing. Go on, please keep laughing.
And she said she'd support cuts to other spending to help the UK rearm. Diplomatically, neither Kemi Badenoch nor the Prime Minister made any mention at all of President Trump or his unprecedented language, for example, saying that a whole civilization will die tonight. But the Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey, didn't hold back.
These words are a stark reminder of how reckless, immoral and completely outside the bounds of international law this president is. Regrettably, he is no friend of the United Kingdom. He's no leader of the free world. He is a dangerous and corrupt gangster, and that is how we must treat him.
He asked the Prime Minister to get the King to call off his forthcoming state visit to the US. On one point, Keir Starmer was frank.
In relation to the language about destroying a civilization, could I really be clear with this House? That was wrong.
But he thought the King could actually help.
The relationship between our two countries is very important on a number of levels, and often what the monarchy is able to do through the bonds that they build is reach through the decades in a situation like this. And the purpose of the visit is to mark the 250th anniversary of the relationship between our country and the United States, and that's why the visit is going ahead.
Reform UK's Richard Tice noted that the price of gas in the US had gone down, while in the UK it had gone up by 50% since the start of the conflict.
Proving, Prime Minister, that if we produce and consume our gas domestically, we can have much lower bills, proving why we must allow the consents for Jackdaw, for Rosebank and all of the oil fields across the North Sea and onshore as well. Yeah.
The Prime Minister repeated his view that while fossil fuels would remain part of the mix, the UK needed to go faster on energy independence through nuclear power and renewables. But that isn't fast enough to help households now. So the SNP Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, wanted some other action.
The best he can muster is to continue to monitor the effects. Now, I appreciate that he might not be in office for very much longer, but whilst he is, the public expect him to provide support. Why isn't he?
The Prime Minister said the most effective action would be getting the Strait of Hormuz reopened. He also condemned Israel's continued bombing of Lebanon, which he said must be included in the ceasefire. But the Green Party's Westminster leader, Ellie Chowns, wanted more.
Sanctions on Netanyahu. Withdraw all permission for the US to use UK bases and UK airspaces to make clear that we will not be an accomplice to the rogue actions of Donald Trump, which endanger us all.
Back in previous world crises, there used to be a lot of talk about the role of the United Nations. Now it barely gets a mention. So there was an old school feel to the question from Christine Jardine, a Lib Dem, about reopening the Strait.
Will the Prime Minister consider going to the United Nations with an emergency motion to the Security Council to get that done and to condemn the actions in the Middle East?
Keir Starmer said the UK had been supporting measures in the UN, but he didn't take her up on the idea that an emergency motion had the power to reopen those shipping lanes.
That's Susan Hume reporting. 12 minutes to 7 now. The lawyer who represented a 20-year-old woman that won millions of pounds in an LA court after Meta and Google were found to have intentionally built addictive social media platforms that harmed her mental health is in the UK this week. Matthew Birdman met ministers yesterday to share what he had learned from working on that landmark case. And he joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
What did you talk to ministers about? What were they interested about hearing about?
Well, I wanted to share what we had learned over 4 years of litigation and 2 months of trial regarding what the social media companies know their platforms are doing to young people and the extent to which their own research establishes that the platforms are dangerous and addictive.
You do have a little bit of positivity to deliver. You do think there are people in those companies who are aware of that and trying to change things.
Well, very much so. I mean, what we learned from the trial was two things. One, that there are many people of conscience within Meta and YouTube that are trying their level best to take some responsibility and make platforms less dangerous to kids. But time and again, those efforts are turned away whenever they impact engagement and profitability. So the lesson that we draw from that is that these companies are not going to change their behavior unless they're forced to do so.
Meta said at the conclusion of that case that they respectfully disagreed with the verdict, that they will appeal. Google said that the case misunderstands YouTube. But as we described it when I spoke to you at the start of the interview, that it is a landmark case. Things will change as a result of what happened.
Well, it is absolutely a landmark case. It is the first time a jury has ever found and that anyone has even had the opportunity to ask a jury to find that these platforms are dangerous to kids and that the companies know it. And particularly impactful is that the jury not only found that Meta and YouTube were negligent, it found that they were malicious in intentionally manufacturing a social media app that is addictive and harmful to kids.
The UK government is one of various around the world that is, well, they're having a consultation on this now, but governments everywhere and parents, in fact, know that this is something that they need to be looking at closely. What advice did you give to ministers when you spoke to them?
Well, I would never presume as an American to tell a British parliamentarian how to vote on a matter of concern to her or his constituents. I simply wanted to share my experience and hopefully instill a fair level of skepticism that anything that the social media companies say they're doing for kids, they're actually doing. And that the prospect of them changing their behavior in anything other than a mandated form is unlikely and I think fanciful.
Matthew Birdman, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
It's now 9 minutes to seven. David Steele, Ming Campbell, Charles Kennedy, Jim Wallace. Anyone familiar with the history of Scottish politics will know that some of the biggest names were Liberal Democrats. When Scots first elected their own devolved government back in 1999, the Lib Dems formed a coalition with Labour. But now the party finds itself trailing in fifth, sometimes sixth place in opinion polls, ahead of next month's Holyrood elections. What's happened? And is there still time to turn things round? We're joined by the leader of the Scottish Lib Dems, Alex Cole-Hamilton. Morning to you, Mr. Cole-Hamilton. What's
gone
wrong?
Well, lots of people ask me questions like this in advance of the 2024 general election, and we surprised everybody, Nick. We overtook the Scottish Conservatives, we trebled our seats in Scotland, we came within touching distance of the SNP and formed part of that amazing result, the best result for Liberals in 100 years across these islands. And we're going to surprise people again because we have the beating of the SNP in 10 constituencies across Scotland. But wherever you are in Scotland, you can use your second peach-coloured regional ballot paper. And for the first time in a long time, we're going to take a massive leap forward on that second regional vote and deliver a vision for change with fairness at its heart.
Isn't the problem here that the votes in Scotland are still determined in large part by which side of the argument you're on, independence or the union, and those like you Liberal Democrats who want to keep Scotland part of the UK are hopelessly divided. There's four parties now arguing for the union.
Well, I'm delighted to say that as much as John Swinney would wish it were otherwise, people will not be casting their vote on a desire for a second independence referendum. And why? Well, we've just seen an Easter getaway or an Easter holiday period where our nation's ferries are just in abject crisis, where every Scottish island is impacted by disruption because of ministerial disinterest in the day job. And that's getting Scotland moving again. We've also got 800,000 Scots currently waiting for treatment because our hospitals are filled with 2,000 patients every night who don't need to be there because they can't get home because want a social care package. Our schools are just not what they used to be, and Lib Dems want to take mobile phones out of classrooms and put pupil support assistance in.
Yeah,
these
I
are
hear
issues.
Your criticism of the failures of the Scottish Government, which has been controlled. I mean, I know you know this, and a lot of our listeners in Scotland will know it, but not everybody will realise that the SNP are asking for a fifth term in power after 20-odd years of running the Scottish Government. Why, though, are they still on course to win?
Well, let me just unpack that. You know, we're talking about a third decade of SNP power, and that's led to all of those problems I've described. I'd probably knock more doors, Nick, than any other party leader in Scotland. I've spoken to nearly 2,000 people in the last 4 weeks, and they... I don't think there's a lot of love for the SNP. And let me say, I do think they're overpriced because whilst obviously they have that unifying sort of cause of independence, they're still, you know, they've lost a third or a quarter of their support since the last Scottish election. I think they're beatable in every constituency in Scotland. So there could be some surprises in store. And my goodness, we need that change because, you know, we have a government that came to power in 2007, for example, promising to dual the A9 to the arterial route to the Highlands that kills more than 10 people every year. And now, 20 years later, we are nowhere on that commitment. Again, going back to healthcare, you know, if we've got some of the longest neurodiversity waits in the country. And again, that's about ministerial disinterest because they've just been focused on the prize of independence, which nobody, Nick, is talking about on the doorsteps.
Well, John Swinney will get the chance to answer that when he's on the programme at around 7:30. I watched you in that debate in Paisley the other night, sitting up in the balcony watching you. And what I was struck by is that leaders were competing to promise more goodies to the electorate. But this comes at a time when the Auditor General for Scotland, independent figure, has said that there's a £5 billion black hole in Scotland's budget. And we know that the war in the Middle East is about to blow apart everyone's budget. Are you not taking the electorate for fools by suggesting that they can pay less tax, they can have more spending, and all will be good?
Not at all. And I come back to that point I made a few moments ago about 2,000 Scots stuck in hospital. I visited Meg McGill in the far north of Scotland last week. She was in hospital for a year after doctors told her she was well enough to go home. They'd adapted her house. They'd put in the ramps and everything like that. But she had to stay in hospital because there was no social care to receive her. On any given night, there are 2,000 Scots like that stuck in hospital, and it's leading to cancelled operations and ambulances unable to discharge into A&E because A&Es are full. And all of that, Nick, is costing the NHS £1.2 million a day. It costs half as much to keep somebody in a care home and quarter as much to keep them in their own.
You're not suggesting, are you, that efficiencies alone will solve problem of an energy crisis globally and a £5 billion black hole?
But it's not just efficiencies, Nick, because if you unlock the crisis in our NHS, you can get those people who are currently waiting for surgery, who are signed off on long-term sick, back to work.
So better management is the Lib Dem promise. Better management
the
government.
Bill. Well, that's part of it. Want to grow the economy.
Great last one, Mr.
Scott
Hamilton. Do you fancy another go in government as the Lib Dems? Would you be prepared to work with the SNP if that's what the electorate suggests?
I think anyone who gets involved in politics wants to make a difference, wants to make changes. And it's very difficult to do that from the benches of opposition. So absolutely. But let me be clear, we will not do any coalition deals with the SNP or Reform. They're part of the problem. They're what's dividing us and holding us back. But we're keen to just elect as many Liberal Democrats as possible who will fight for those changes I've described and fight for communities door by door and street by street.
Alex Cole-Hamilton, leader of the Scottish Lib Dems. Thank you very much.
The stories we tell, about the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
If you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go?
Glasgow.
So where are you from then?
The Glens of Antrim.
Lovely part of the world.
Can we just move to Barry? It's well lush.
Hello, love. Welcome to Barry. You'll always be
my home. Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Time for the weather now. Here's Elizabeth.
Hello, good morning again. Well, it's a very different day to yesterday when it was sunshine and showers. Today, a lot of the rain will be fairly light and patchy. It's just edging in from the west. It's a chilly, sunny start to the day for many central and eastern areas. There's been a touch of frost, temperatures in low single figures for many. Cloudier and milder towards parts of Northern Ireland, Wales and southwest England in particular. And there's quite a bit of patchy rain around as well, a bit of hill and coastal fog. And then that weather front is going to be tracking eastwards as we head throughout the day. Fresh to locally strong southerly to southeasterly winds towards the west. For central and western Scotland, for much of England, that bright early start will give way to cloud as we head through the morning. So cloud amounts increasing as our weather front pushes further northwards and eastwards, and there will be some patchy outbreaks of rain around at times. For southeast England and for northern and eastern Scotland, this is where we'll hang on to the brightness for much of the day. So still some sunshine, even into the afternoon. It's a bit warmer than it was yesterday with that southerly wind, 11 to 15 Celsius for most, 10 degrees in northern and western Scotland, but we might just squeak up to 17 Celsius perhaps in central and eastern England. So perhaps still a bit of evening brightness for eastern areas, northern Scotland tonight. It's not going to be as cold tonight. That's because there's a lot more cloud around and there'll be more weather fronts moving in from the west. It's going to be quite a wet early start for western Wales and southwest England, western Scotland. Some heavy rain here. The rain lighter, a bit more patchy elsewhere, and it will be turning windier too overnight. We'll start off tomorrow morning on 8 to 11 degrees Celsius. Bit warmer tomorrow, some heavy rain for many.
Thank you, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Glasgow and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 14th of April. The headlines this morning, the former head of NATO, Lord Robertson, who is one of those behind a major review of defence, has said the government hasn't made the necessary investment in the armed services. He says there's a corrosive complacency. We'll speak to another co-author of that strategic defence review, General Sir Richard Barons, after this bulletin. The US Vice President, J.D. Vance, said there was progress with Iran during talks at the weekend, but he's described the country's closure of the Strait of Hormuz as an act of economic terrorism. The BBC understands the police watchdog is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force over its initial investigation into a fatal crash in Wimbledon in 2023.
Also on this morning's programme...
You know, for working-class families... We're in a worse position than we've ever been, so there's nobody fighting our corner here.
Nick is in Scotland this morning, voting for its next parliament in just over 3 weeks' time. So we'll be hearing from the leaders of the SNP and Labour about their promises to families who are feeling the pinch and why looking up can sometimes lead to some of the most beautiful sights in the world. Before that, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
A former Labour cabinet minister who last year carried out a major review of the UK's armed forces has mounted a scathing attack on the government's handling of defence. Lord Robertson, who served as NATO Secretary General, will use a speech to warn of a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. The former Defence Secretary under Tony Blair will also warn about the impact of the expanding welfare budget on defence spending, claiming the UK's national security is in peril. Here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
Lord Robertson oversaw Labour's comprehensive review of defence policy that was published last year. But the investment plan to fund that vision has since been repeatedly delayed. Now, in a significant intervention, Lord Robertson will accuse what he calls non-military experts in the Treasury of vandalism. We are underprepared. We are underinsured. We are under attack. We are not safe, he will say in a speech today. Britain's national security and safety is in peril. There has been deadlock in government over the defence investments plan. The Prime Minister has said it is on his desk and he will resolve the matter. But with the Ministry of Defence already facing a reported £28 billion funding shortfall, there are questions over where the extra money would come from. Lord Robertson will say, "We cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget." A government spokesperson said the Strategic Defence Review was backed by the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War, and the investment plan would be published as soon as possible.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused the Iranian government of engaging in an act of economic terrorism by stopping ships from using the Strait of Hormuz. Speaking to Fox News, he said President Trump had shown that two could play at that game. Yesterday, the US began its own blockade of Iranian ports. Mr. Vance, who led the negotiation team during talks with Iran at the weekend, said there had been progress despite the failure to reach an agreement. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
J.D. Vance said if the Iranians engaged in economic terrorism over the Strait of Hormuz, the US would abide by the same principle and make sure none of the country's ships got out of Iran either. He accused Tehran of moving the goalpost during talks at the weekend, saying that he'd expected the Iranians to fully reopen the strait in return for a ceasefire. And he elaborated on other sticking points.
We must have the enriched material out of Iran. We must have their conclusive commitment to not develop a nuclear weapon. And I think that if the Iranians are willing to meet us there, then this can be a very, very good deal for both countries.
He insisted that both sides had made some progress in the negotiation, but that it was now up to Iran to make the next move. The ball, he said, was very much in their court.
Talks between Lebanese and Israeli ambassadors to the US are expected to take place in Washington later. It will be the first time in decades that officials from the two countries, which don't have diplomatic relations, meet face to face for direct negotiations. The head of the International Energy Agency says the current level of energy prices do not reflect the severity of the problem in the Gulf. Fatih Birol was speaking as the world's leading finance figures, including the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, arrived in Washington for the International Monetary Fund's spring meetings. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, reports from Washington.
Oil prices have been mainly above $100 a barrel since the US and Israeli conflict with Iran started, driving up petrol and diesel costs. The head of the International Energy Agency believes that these global prices do not reflect the severity of the supply problem as tankers in the Gulf failed to load fuel this month. The long-term impact on the world economy will be addressed by finance ministers who have gathered here. Prospects for global growth are expected to be downgraded before the war an upgrade had been forecast. Against this dark cloud, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will tell her international colleagues to coordinate their efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and to protect ordinary households from rising costs.
The BBC understands that the police watchdog, the IOPC, is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force over its response to a fatal crash at a South London school in 2023. 2 8-year-old children, Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau, died after a Land Rover hit an end-of-term tea party at the Study Preparatory School in Wimbledon. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
When the police carried out its first investigation into the Wimbledon school crash, it ended with the driver, Claire Fremantle, facing no charges as prosecutors said she'd had an undiagnosed epileptic seizure. The parents of Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau always said the investigation was flawed and it was reopened in 2024. The police watchdog will examine the way it was carried out, including allegations that race was a factor in the way officers treated the girls' families and if the police gave false information to them. 4 serving police officers, including a commander and a former officer, are being investigated for possible gross misconduct. The Metropolitan Police said it would provide every assistance to the police watchdog. The parents of Nuria and Selina told the BBC that while they are encouraged by the IOPC investigation, the truth must come to light. Prosecutors now have a full file of evidence from the police. The families are waiting for them to decide on charges.
The founder of China's biggest property development company, Evergrande, has pleaded guilty to a number of charges, including embezzlement of corporate assets and corporate bribery. Hui Kaiyan, formerly China's richest man, presided over the firm as it accumulated hundreds of billions of pounds of debt. A BBC investigation has uncovered fresh, wide-ranging evidence that Greek police have for years been recruiting migrants to force other migrants back across its river border with Turkey. This practice is generally considered illegal under international law. Our Europe correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
Over months, we've pieced together evidence from migrants and police sources, as well as leaked and official documents. Evidence which indicates the Greek authorities have recruited Afghans, Syrians, Pakistanis and others, as so-called mercenaries, since around 2020 in Evros, where a river of the same name marks the land border between Greece and Turkey. The mercenaries, we've heard, can be paid in cash and mobiles looted from migrants or papers that in effect afford them passage into the EU. Their job? To force other migrants onto boats and back to Turkey in a pushback operation that, according to witness accounts, can involve people being stripped, beaten and even sexually assaulted. The government hasn't responded to our written request for comment. When we doorstepped the Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, he told us he was totally unaware about claims that migrants had been used to carry out pushbacks, but that Greece was protecting its and the EU's borders.
A record six British artists are to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in November. They are Oasis, Phil Collins, Sade, Billy Idol and Iron Maiden, together with Joy Division and New Order, who are being treated as one group. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
The inductees were announced during last night's edition of the TV talent show American Idol, a somewhat incongruous setting when the list included the famously gloomy Manchester band Joy Division. Phil Collins is now in for his solo work, having already been accepted as a member of Genesis. Your love is key. Sade is the first ever black British woman to be included. Iron Maiden and Billy Idol are both to be honoured. While it will be interesting to see if Oasis turn up to the ceremony in November, Liam Gallagher had previously said about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame he didn't need an award from a geriatric in a cowboy hat.
Colin Patterson reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's now 9 minutes past seven. We are underprepared, we're underinsured, we're under attack, we are not safe. That is the stark warning being issued today by the man chosen by the Prime Minister to help write the Strategic Defence Review, the former NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson, a former Labour Defence Secretary. We're joined by another of the authors of that Strategic Defence Review published last year, General Sir Richard Barons. Good morning to you, Sir Richard.
Good morning.
Do you share Lord Robertson's concerns?
I completely share them. He and I have been saying this through the review and since the review was published. But I think it's a mark of how serious it is that someone who has been a Labour Party activist for more than 60 years and was a NATO Secretary General has now had to say it in these terms today.
Well, when you say it, for people not following the debate, spell it out. What is your criticism of what the Prime Minister, what the Chancellor are doing or perhaps failing to do?
So I think the key thoughts here are, first of all, we clearly live in a very difficult and dangerous world, and we have left the relative comfort of what we call the post-Cold War era. That evaporated from about 2014 onwards. But we've arrived in this very dangerous world with the armed forces we ended up with after more than 35 years of making the armed forces smaller and hollowing them out, because in the post-Cold War era, we couldn't point to the sort of threats that we would need big and ready armed forces for. So, of course, there's an enormous gap between where we have to be to keep the country safe in the world we now live in and where we actually are. And conversations in recent weeks about getting a single ship to provide air defence in the Mediterranean are an example of how difficult things are.
Pete Hegseth, the US Defence Secretary, who prefers to be called the Secretary of War, mocking the Royal Navy. How did that make you feel?
Well, I think, and many others, I hung my head in sorrow, but I couldn't argue with him, because although the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force and the Army are in their bones. Outstanding institutions, they are simply too small and too undernourished to deal with the world that we now live in. And the review says this, and the review charted a course of not just revitalization, but transformation for war in the 21st century. So all the ideas are there. And we agreed, and this was, of course, the government's review, a profile over 10 years to get to a better place. But we said then that 10 years is way too long. It's essentially twice as long as the risks should allow us to go.
So this is, in essence, an argument about money and your view that the government needs to spend it now. Now, the Prime Minister says that what in the jargon is called the Defence Investment Plan is on his desk and it's being finalised, he says. Is your worry that what is on his desk isn't nearly good enough and he isn't planning to spend enough fast enough?
So the problem with the Defence Investment Plan, which is the articulation of the review's 62 recommendations into a programme of funded activity over 10 years, is it should have come out last September. At the heart of it, that SDR programme needs, the public figure is, another $28 billion in the first 4 years to be affordable. And the choice that's on the Prime Minister's desk is they either find more money to implement this, in my view, de minimis review at the speed we agreed last year, or he's going to announce £28 billion worth of cuts. And how would that fit with the world that we find ourselves in today?
Do you think that what we've seen in this war in the Middle East increases the need for more defence spending? Because some people suggest that we can no longer rely on the United States and we have to defend ourselves.
So I think all of that applies. The war, which we're witnessing playing out over Iran now, illustrates very clearly that we have to transform the armed forces for war in the digital age, for war in the 21st century. And the armed forces know how to do that. They just don't have the money soon enough or at a large enough scale to get on with it at the speed required to play a reasonable part in NATO. And NATO, as we've seen through Greenland and a lot of difficult conversations subsequently, has to recognise it will be a NATO with European NATO doing much more and the US doing much less. The US cavalry is not coming to bail us out now.
General Sir Richard Barons, thank you very much indeed for joining us. The Prime Minister always points out that there has been, in his words, the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War, but he knows the pressure is on to spend a great deal more than that, given the state of the British Armed Forces.
It's 14 minutes past seven now. After the first part of the Southport inquiry was published yesterday, the government's promised to bring forward new legislation to close a loophole that means that individuals who plan violent attacks without a particular ideological motive can fall through the legal net. Now, in that case, despite the attacker being referred to the Prevent programme three times, there was confusion about whether he should be taken on, because even though he was fixated on violence, he hadn't shown a clear ideology, a reason for it. And he went on to murder three girls, as you know, at a dance class in 2024. As the Home Secretary said in the Commons yesterday, unlike terrorist attacks, if you're planning an attack without an underlying ideology, there is no crime on the statute book. Well, let's speak to Lord Anderson, the Independent Prevent Commissioner and the former independent reviewer of anti-terrorism legislation. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is interesting that this loophole exists. It is not the sort of thing that one would have thought would not be covered under the law.
I think for many years, people have thought of the consequences of terrorism as uniquely horrific. And for that reason, we have a range of criminal offences which only applies to terrorism. What they basically do is allow someone to be prosecuted at a very early stage. They haven't committed an act of terrorism. They haven't even reached the stage of attempt, and they haven't been involved in inciting anybody else or conspiring with anybody else, perhaps because they're working alone. And as you say, the most widely used of these is the offence of attack planning or preparing an act of terrorism. So if you search someone's house and you find weapons and a note that showed an intention to use them, for example, for maybe an attack on a synagogue, racial, religious, ideological purpose, that's attack planning for terrorism. The reason there's a gap in the law is because, as Ken McCallum has recently said, the Director General of MI5, we're seeing an increasing number of would-be attackers, including mass killers like the Southport killer, who are motivated by non-ideological reasons, as he put it, driven by personal grievance, fixation, or mental disturbance. Those people are not terrorists because they're not motivated by ideology, but they can be just as deadly as terrorists. It's not just a Southport attacker. You think of Jake Davison, who shot and killed five people in Plymouth before shooting himself, the teenagers in North Yorkshire who were making explosives with the ambition of committing one of the worst atrocities in British history. Some are copycats. For example, the Columbine school shooters. There's been one convicted copycat of the Southport killer himself. It can be violence for the sake of violence, violence for the sake of notoriety. And I think if someone is planning an attack, which your family could be a victim of, and supposing that attack goes through, it is just as terrible, regardless of whether in the killer's mind is a clear or stable ideology. And I think the idea the government has, which was actually supported by my successor as independent reviewer, and which I will certainly support if it comes to Parliament, is to level that playing field a bit and accept, yes, terrorism is dreadful, but other forms of mass killing and mass attacks can be just as terrible for their effects on individual families.
One of the great difficulties in this particular case were the multiple failings among different agencies at different levels. Now, obviously, bringing in new laws will sort of plug part of that, but that won't solve the problem on its own, will it?
It wouldn't have solved the problem here because they didn't even get as far as arresting him and searching his house when he had the rice in, when he had the crossbow and the guns and so on. Of course, had they done that, they might well have had the evidence to proceed for this new attack planning offence. But it's important to think about these things before they happen. I've got no doubt that this would be a useful addition to the arsenal. It's very well stocked already, but it's been focusing very much on the ideological side. And I think we need to focus on threats to society more generally. I'd say the same, incidentally, about the PREVENT programme, which actually doesn't work badly on the whole, in relation to people who are ideologically motivated. But again, as this Rita Cabana case showed in Southport, it fell down when there was a person whose ideology was jumbled and not clear. And we've got to do something about that as well.
Lord Anderson, the outgoing Independent PREVENT Commissioner, former independent reviewer of anti-terrorism legislation. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past seven. Let's turn to the business news now. There's a warning this morning about the world of private credit, lending done by investors rather than banks. Sean can tell us more.
Yeah, and alongside those warnings that we've heard in recent times, Nick, we now have a major pension scheme that's actually investing in this sector. So Nest, people might be familiar with Nest. It's the UK's biggest workplace pension scheme, including for many earning the minimum wage. It's investing now, it says, hundreds of millions of pounds in this private credit, this type of lending from investment funds, not from banks as we typically know it, that the likes of the Governor of the Bank of England have been warning about recently. Elizabeth Fernando is Nest's Chief Investment Officer, joins us now. Good morning. Why are you sort of targeting this market, particularly in the United States, when so many others, we hear, are trying to get out?
Good morning. And I think the first thing is that it's really important in any kind of private market investing, but particularly private credit, is that you get to be selective and having deep, thoughtful due diligence to identify which companies to back and which ones to avoid, so that you generate those superior investment returns is really important. I've been an investor for many years, and one of the big lessons I've learned over my career is that it's much better to be buying when competition is for the best assets is lower. You get to secure better terms, and therefore you get better future returns. And then finally, I'd say this forms part of our globally diversified portfolio. It will give us access to one of the deepest corporate lending markets in the world. And it means that our members will benefit from the great growth that we've seen out of the US economy, and it will help move us towards our ambition of having 30% invested in private markets.
Well, you obviously have these long-term aims. Does it mean, from what you're saying, it sounds like you're sort of recognising some of the concerns that the Bank of England, for example, and many others, we've heard the boss of JP Morgan talk about this recently as well. You're recognising some of the concerns they have. Do you sort of feel that you may have to weather a storm of losses on this before you see the returns in the longer run?
So I think a lot of what we've seen up till now has been a liquidity issue. It's been a question of how people invest rather than a systematic problem with the quality of the credit that's being extended. That there have clearly been problems, First Brands being a poster child of that. We do think that if you're investing with thoughtful, high quality due diligence, with a partner with a long-term track record in this space, that you can sidestep most of the issues that could arise in this market.
Okay, Elizabeth Fernando, Nest's Chief Investment Officer. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sean. It's 22 minutes past seven. We talked on the programme, you might remember last week, about the EU's new digital entry exit system and the fact that it wasn't ready in time, even on the day that it was supposed to come fully online. And since then, there have been instances of huge queues in some European airports. In one case, around 100 passengers were left behind in Milan because they couldn't get through passport control in time to make their flight before it took off. One of them, Carol Boone, spoke to PM.
As soon as we got to the passport control, there was already a huge queue, you know, and we didn't think we'd have a problem, but it just grew and grew. There was just carnage. People were being sick. There was one person that I think that nearly fainted. I think we were in that queue for 2 hours, to nearly 3 hours. We got to passport control and they turned around and said, it's gone, your flight's gone.
Well, Julia Lubu-Said is CEO of the travel agency Advantage Travel Partnership. Julia, good morning.
Good morning.
What is the problem here? What is the difficulty? Why is it taking people so long to get through?
I think the issues are, I mean, they are isolated. We are seeing the bottlenecks and the incidents like yesterday, not as bad as yesterday, I have to say, in some of these European airports. And the real sheer issue is the volume of passengers that are trying to go through border control at one time is clearly creating significant bottlenecks. The biggest frustration is these airports know what passengers are arriving. They know how many flights are coming in. They have the flight manifest. There needs to be better coordination on arrival and on departure, because the same thing happens when you leave, to ensure we are not facing a summer of complete chaos.
Yeah, I mean, that and those words, summer of complete chaos, is the sort of thing that when people's, you know, fingers are hovering over booking a summer holiday, it's the kind of thing they'll think of and maybe change their mind.
Well, this is the biggest frustration. I mean, my network is that we're a network of independent travel agents all across the country, clearly having quite a difficult time right now, but working really hard to make sure they can reassure their customers. And the challenge is that this is really unavoidable. This is avoidable. You know, these queues do not need to happen. If there is better preparedness from the airports, better control of how many people are needed to register, because actually it is in their gift to pause registration if they see there are too many passengers arriving.
Mm. Do you think they will? It's been a bit of a sticky rollout in the first place. It hasn't gone as planned at all, has it? Up until this stage even.
Yeah, so it's been, we've had this transition phase really since October. There's been lots of testing in different airports where they've had the registration kiosks on, then they've paused them when they've needed. But they still have it's in their gift to pause if required for up to 6 hours a day. So the system really isn't working. I mean, what is needed is this. One of the solutions here is that the app that they are looking to roll out, which is not live for every jurisdiction, so people can pre-register. It's logical that is a really key tool that's going to really eliminate some of these queues, so you don't have people having to do the registration exclusively when they get to the airports.
Right. Is there any indication, are you getting anything back from the EU that suggests that your concerns are being listened to and might be acted upon?
I think the only concerns that really are being listened to is this ability to pause if required. But I think that message needs to come really strong from the EU to the Schengen area and the member states, because it will create confidence issues. PAC people will vote with their feet and they'll travel outside the Schengen area. They really will. So it's not in anyone's interest to get this wrong. So we really need for the EU to consider robust contingency planning, ensure that we don't endure a summer of chaos, ensure where there are bottlenecks at some of these airports where there just isn't capacity to hold people, a bit like you've seen in Milan. I mean, Milan is quite a well-used airport. It would know how many people were looking to depart that day. They could have paused registration to allow people to seamlessly depart on time and not miss their flights.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on it, as I'm sure many people will. Julia, thank you. Julia Lubu Said, who's CEO of the travel agency Advantage Travel Partnership.
Time for the sport now with Carthy at 27 minutes past seven. Morning, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much, Nick. Leeds United had a 2-1 win over Manchester United in the Premier League last night. It was a first league win for Leeds at Old Trafford since 1981 and means they are 6 points clear of the relegation zone. Attention turns to the Champions League tonight, and Arne Slot insists his Liverpool side still believe they can do something special against Paris Saint-Germain in the return leg of their quarter-final later. Let's speak to the BBC's chief football writer. Morning, Phil McNulty.
Morning, Carthy.
Slot sounds pretty firm in his belief that Liverpool can win this tie despite PSG having a two-goal advantage from the first leg. What are Liverpool's potential chances of overturning that?
Well, I think if Liverpool can take one small piece of comfort from the 2-0 loss in Paris last week, it was the fact that the margin of defeat could have been much greater, such was the gulf between the sides and the number of opportunities PSG created but failed to take. It actually kept the result in manageable proportions, but Liverpool still face a mammoth task against the reigning Champions League holders, a team with high class running right through it, and who, like last season, seem to be hitting form at the right time. Obviously, the Anfield factor will be mentioned, as it always is on these European nights, but PSG may well feel more confident because, of course, they won there last season after losing the first leg in Paris before going through on penalties at the last 16 stage. But Slot and Liverpool will at least feel they've given themselves a chance to turn it around.
Yeah, I think Slot has mentioned the fans really will come into their own tonight, hasn't he? And that Liverpool didn't manage a shot on target in France last week. There's also this side of the argument that Ligue 1 postponed PSG's match at the weekend, agreeing to PSG's request to postpone that match. How much of an effect could that have tonight for the French side?
Well, it's certainly the sort of luxury Liverpool and others wouldn't mind being afforded by the Premier League, but it won't be happening anytime soon, I don't think. PSG will be rested, so they will be feeling better about that. But I think the good thing for Liverpool is that in the game they played in between these two legs, they got a decent win against Fulham that keeps them right in the Champions League places, and at least it lifted some confidence after three pretty bad defeats, and with Mohamed Salah getting a goal, so maybe they can take something from that as well.
And can I just ask you about the Premier League from last night? I mentioned that massive result for Leeds United. There were, though, some boos at Old Trafford for Manchester United losing 2-1 to Leeds. How concerned will Michael Carrick be with that result?
Well, I think he will be a bit concerned. It was the first home defeat of his time in charge, and it was particularly disappointing, particularly in the first half when they went 2-0 down. They actually played better with 10 men than 11 after Lisandro Martinez was sent off. On the other side of the coin, it was hugely significant for Leeds, their first away win in the league at Old Trafford since 1981, and it gives them that 6-point gap between the relegation places and increases the pressure on the likes of Spurs, West Ham and Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, interesting times in the Premier League in the last few matches of the season. Phil McNulty, who'll be at Liverpool Anfield tonight. Thank you very much. And just a few other headlines for you. England women face World Cup champions Spain tonight in a World Cup qualifier. Scotland host Belgium. Wales face Albania and Northern Ireland host Malta. And a bit of tennis news to finish. The British number one, Cam Norrie, beat Stan Wawrinka in three sets at the Barcelona Open to reach the second round. But Jack Draper had to retire during his first round match because of a knee injury. It was Draper's first clay court match of the season.
Thank you, Carthy. Later this afternoon, Radio 4 invites you to closely inspect a masterpiece.
They're sitting in the bow of the boat, and it kind of encloses the whole painting, really.
Take a detailed look at three great masterpieces.
Van Eyck can paint a mirror so convincingly and with such skill that it acts as a real mirror.
Appreciate the genius of Jan van Eyck, Mary Cassatt and Nicholas Hilliard.
He uses squirrel hairs, you know, eyelashes, to paint the tiny, tiny details that we see.
The new series of Moving Pictures, with me, Cathy Fitzgerald, starts this afternoon at 4. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
It's just breathtaking.
Quick look at the weather now. Sunshine in the east to start, cloudy for all later, with spells of rain.
I think we're both going to get that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Glasgow, Anna Foster in Salford, and at just after 7:30, Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
A former Labour cabinet minister who last year carried out a Rouge and Branch review of the armed forces has mounted a scathing attack on the government's handling of defence. Lord Robertson, who also served as NATO Secretary General, will warn in a speech of a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. There's been deadlock in government over its defence investment plan, although the Prime Minister has said he will resolve the matter. The former head of Joint Forces Command, General Sir Richard Barons, told us that if the plan wasn't implemented, the armed forces would in effect face £28 billion of cuts. Ministers insist they've carried out the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused the Iranian government of engaging in an act of economic terrorism by stopping ships from using the Strait of Hormuz. Yesterday, the US began its own blockade of Iranian ports. Talks between Lebanese and Israeli ambassadors to the UK, US, are expected to take place in Washington later. It will be the first time in decades that officials from the two countries, which don't have diplomatic relations, meet face-to-face for direct negotiations. The police watchdog, the IOPC, is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force over its response to a fatal crash at a South London school in 2023. Two children, Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau, who were both eight, died after a Land Rover hit an end-of-term tea party at the Study Preparatory School in Wimbledon. Four serving police officers and a former officer are being investigated for possible gross misconduct. The founder of China's biggest property development company, Evergrande, has pleaded guilty to a number of charges, including embezzlement of corporate assets and corporate bribery. Hui Kaiyan, formerly China's richest man, presided over the firm as it accumulated hundreds of billions of pounds of debt.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 27 minutes to eight now. No oil is moving out of the Gulf, and there's no sign of a deal between Iran and the United States, which might get it moving once again. If that deadlock continues, our world looks set to be reshaped by a global energy crisis, with soaring prices hitting families and businesses. Here at home, Scotland is at the heart of that debate about how we should respond. For years, the SNP campaigned for Scottish independence under the slogan, "It's Scotland's oil." Now, in the campaign to secure a fifth consecutive term in power in Edinburgh, the SNP's party leader, the First Minister John Swinney, says he wants to make sure we've got Scotland's energy in Scotland's hands. Well, the First Minister and the leader of the SNP joins us on the line. Good morning to you, First Minister.
Morning, Nick.
Let's begin with energy. I know you've got concerns about wind power that we will come to in a moment. But first, let's return to that famous slogan, "It's Scotland's oil." Do you want this crisis to lead to a change of mind, allowing Scotland's oil and gas to be developed to the full to deal with this energy crisis?
What I've said is that where there are any new applications coming forward to develop oil and gas resources in the North Sea sector, there has got to be a climate compatibility assessment undertaken to determine whether that oil or gas can be extracted and utilised in a way that is compatible with our objectives to reach net zero by 2045.
Will you forgive me in suggesting that's not the clearest answer that I've ever heard on the Today programme? It's not a complicated question, is it? There are current fields in which there's oil and gas that could be developed. The SNP always opposed that in the past. Is the answer yes, develop it now, or no, don't?
Well, the answer is complicated, Nick, because there are court judgments that say that what I've just outlined to you, if the need for there to be climate compatibility assessments undertaken, is essentially the legal requirement in the United Kingdom. So that's got to be undertaken to make sure that the extraction of oil and gas is compatible with our actions on climate
change. But you
change.
Are allowed an opinion, and Nicola Sturgeon, who was elected as First Minister at the last Holyrood election, was very clear about it. She said developing Rosebank, the oil field, would be the greatest act of environmental vandalism in our lifetime. She was clear. The answer was no. Can John Swinney give a clear answer? Is it no, like Sturgeon? Or is it yes, like the Conservatives and Reform? Or is it not sure?
Well, the Conservatives and Reform, I beg to suggest, are taking a very different stance, which is an environmentally irresponsible stance.
So what's yours?
And the stance, mine is environmentally responsible, that we've got to consider any individual application based on its compatibility with our climate
journey.
So
yours is maybe.
But there's also another element which is important, and this is the significant difference of the last few weeks and months in the Iran conflict, is the question of energy security of supply. because we are going to be using, even on our journey to net zero, oil and gas resources in the years to come. And we have to be confident about where they will be coming from and how they can be supported. And obviously, there has been enormous disruption to that supply by the unwarranted intervention by the United States and Israel in Iran and the disruption of supplies that have come about as a consequence.
Which is precisely why I'm asking you what your energy policy would be. Maybe, it seems to be, you're saying, on oil and gas. How about nuclear? The last remaining nuclear power station in Scotland, Torness, is going to close in 2030. The SNP have always opposed nuclear power. Do you still oppose green, clean nuclear power?
I oppose nuclear energy development, yes. And okay. I do that for a number of reasons. I think it's a very expensive proposition. I think there are huge environmental concerns about it in relation to waste. And also, on our doorstep, we have the most colossal amount of renewable energy potential. Now, one of the things I'm most proud about the performance of the SNP government in the last 19 years is that we've made huge progress in the development of Scotland's renewable energy potential. And we've got so much more to do in relation to offshore wind development and other resources, pump storage, which can contribute to our energy mix.
Now, you've criticised... Forgive me interrupting you, but I wanted to get to the point of the election here, where you criticised that the debate I attended the other night in Paisley. You were clear that you thought the UK government was blocking Scotland getting a new wind turbine factory. And you seem to suggest, are you really suggesting this? It was for political reasons, because they say they don't want Scotland's energy in China's hands. It's a Chinese government that would do it. They say there are security worries about that. Are you saying that you want Scotland's power in China's hands?
Well, I want Scotland's power in Scotland's hands, and I want there to be a manufacturing benefit from the generation of renewable energy in Scotland coming to people in Scotland, with the development of the manufacturing capacity to develop the infrastructure that's required. And, of course, what I don't have from the United Kingdom government is an explanation of why they have blocked the development of that manufacturing capability by the Chinese company Mingyang.
Well, they make clear it's on security grounds, don't they? And they've got the backing of the all-party select committee on business in the House of Commons. I ask you again, are you playing politics with this, John Swinney, implying that they are inventing security concerns?
Well, what I want to understand from the UK government is why on earth they've taken the decision that they've taken, because there's been no transparent explanation to me.
Well, they've told you it's on security grounds.
Well, that is the sum total of the explanation. And forgive me, Nick, for wanting to have a bit more information about what is the rationale for that and what alternatives have been looked at to try to make sure that those security considerations could be overcome. Because there are many voices that say that that could be the case. Because what I'm interested in is making sure that Scotland, unlike the experience in North Sea oil and gas, actually reaps the reward of the use and development of our energy resources. Yep. Because £350 billion has gone from the North Sea sector to the UK Treasury, and Scotland has got nothing in return. Yep. And I don't want a repeat of that of that situation.
Except, of course, it's UK taxpayers that are paid to build those wind farms off Scotland's coast, not just Scotland's taxpayers. Now, why people say that you're raising this, your critics at least suggest, is you always want to talk about the things that Scotland government hasn't got responsibility for. You are responsible for so much in this country. You're responsible for the schools, for the hospitals, for the police, for the law. And let's take one example that's in the news, the ferries. Your government that's been in power for 20 years has managed to spend almost £1 billion building a brand new ferry fleet, vital for supplying people and ferrying people who live on the islands, half of which currently don't function. One went out yesterday, and when they were launched by your predecessor Nicola Sturgeon, they had wooden windows that were painted so that cameras thought they were ready for operation. It is a symbol, is it not, of your government's failure?
Well, since the SNP came to office, we've put into the Calmac fleet 9 new ferries, and there are 11 new ferries on order, some of which will come, 3 of which will come later on this year into the Calmac fleet. Now, I was in Oban yesterday. I saw the MV Isle of Islay, a brand new ferry that's part of the network in Oban, sailing from Oban to Barra, part of the Western Isles network. Yes, of course, I acknowledge that there are current difficulties because of the annual maintenance of the fleet and also a breakdown on the Loch Seaforth between Stornoway and Ullapool, which I very much regret, and Calmac are working very hard on alternative provisions.
But my suggestion was it was a symbol of something bigger. It was a symbol of something bigger, I was suggesting. And you've got a wider problem, haven't you, First Minister, which is the Auditor-General, an independent figure, has said you've got a £5 billion black hole in your government's plans to spend. Now, the other day you said that might have to lead to cuts in public sector jobs. Will you, when you launch your manifesto this week, be clear with the Scottish public that if you're re-elected, you might have to cut jobs in the public sector, you might have to put their taxes up, you might have to cut spending?
Well, I certainly made clear last summer when the government published its public service reform strategy that there would have to be reductions in public sector employment and there would have to be reductions in the number of public bodies that we take forward. And I've been very open about that. I've also demonstrated to people in Scotland for the last 19 years, that the SNP has, and I've demonstrated it for 10 of those last 19 years as Finance Minister, that the SNP knows how to balance a budget and that we live within our resources because we've balanced our budget on every single year since we came to office in 2007. So yes, there are issues that we have to confront in the period going forward, but we do it by reforming our public services, getting a shift into prevention, making sure the good work we're doing to reduce waiting lists in the health service is carried on. Waiting lists are now down by for 9 months in a row for long waits, outpatients and inpatients. We've got the highest levels of literacy and numeracy that are on record in Scottish education. Crime is down 40% since the SNP came to office. So that's a record I'm proud of, and I'll set out to the people of Scotland.
John Swinney, First Minister of Scotland, for now, and he hopes to be afterwards, and the leader of the Scottish National Party. Thank you for taking the time.
17 minutes to 8 now. Households will be offered free electricity to do their laundry on sunny weekends to help prevent Britain's power grid being swamped with surplus solar energy this summer, so says the front page of this morning's Times. This is being launched by the National Energy System Operator to reward you and I, families, but businesses as well, that increase their electricity use when there is an oversupply of energy. So how will it work? Claire Barrett is Consumer Editor of the Financial Times. Morning, Claire.
Good morning.
This, I think it's always worth going back to basics at moments like this. This always used to be a problem that energy couldn't be stored. Is that what it is? It needs to be used as it's generated.
Yeah, so I think this is a smart idea for two reasons, because it solves two problems. One is a better way of managing the peaks and troughs of renewable power generation, as you said, and two, it helps us, consumers and businesses, save money on our energy bills, and goodness knows everybody is wanting to and motivated to do that at the moment. So I think there'll be huge interest in this scheme. So you're completely right. When you've got a situation, a sunny or a windy weekend, so consumer demand is low, we're relying more on solar farms and wind farms to power the grid. But what happens in those situations is that more electricity is generated than is being consumed. So at the moment, the National Energy Systems Operator has got two choices. It can either pay the solar farms and the wind farms to switch off, or it can pay suppliers to take that energy off the grid. And there are already some, like Octopus and British Gas, who are incentivised customers to use more energy at peak times, either because they'll get a cut price deal on the power that they're using, or even free, or even in some cases be paid to do that. So if it can shift consumer demand in a significant way through this new demand flexibility service, then that's a really good way of saving money for the government, but also for people.
Yeah, I mean, when you say, Claire, that people like anything free, quite right, people's eyes will light up at that. But I suppose when you're thinking about households, you can very easily stick in a wash or hoover the house or do what you want to do. But businesses, if we're talking about weekends, it would surely be much harder for them to suddenly swing into action and increase their energy use without much notice.
Yeah, I suspect that there are certain types of businesses who might be better placed to be flexible. But yeah, certainly with labour patterns and shift patterns, having to pay people to come in. But, you know, maybe people will get better at predicting when this might happen so they can plan ahead. But I mean, I think if we go back to people, because consumer demand obviously is a huge part of this, especially with everything that's going on around the world and the pressure on the government to perhaps think about subsidising energy bills further into the year. If you have got a situation where suppliers can sign up, the way this will work is if you've got a smart meter, they can then alert their customers in certain geographical areas where there is a surplus. At the moment with the Octopus scheme, that works in like half hour increments. So they can say for the next half an hour, power is priced at this rate, for the next half an hour, power is priced at this rate. So there really is an incentive to shift your energy consumption if you can, as you say, fill up the laundry basket and think, it's going to be sunny at the weekend. Yes. Maybe I'll get a text from my energy supplier. But it will only work for electric appliances, of course. So more incentive to shift away from gas in our homes towards electricity. And yes, also people are already commenting online, you know, if you've got internal batteries in your house that you can charge up, which are increasingly a feature of the more modern power system, that's something you could do. Charging an electric car, you know, so there are developments in technology that are sort of helping consumers with smarter homes to take higher advantage of these kinds of schemes.
Okay, interesting. Claire, thank you. Claire Barrett, who's a consumer editor of the Financial Times.
It's now 13 minutes to eight. We were talking just a moment ago about the energy crisis. We're going to be talking about whether it will be possible to clear the Strait of Hormuz with the UN Maritime Organization. That's coming up in a moment. First, though, it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Jasveer Singh, co-chair of the City Sikhs charity and trustee of the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. Sikhs are celebrating the festival of Vaisakhi today. It's perhaps the most important date in the religious calendar, marking the creation of the Khalsa, the inner core of the Sikh faith. And whilst the colourful and joyous festivities can last for weeks, its origins lie in a fight for survival against the odds. 350 years ago, when the ninth Guru and his loyal companions were publicly executed in the Mughal Emperor's order for refusing to convert, Sikhs in the local area were afraid to recover his body in case they too met a similar fate. The young 10th Guru found himself in a dilemma. How could he ensure that his disciples would be brave enough to do the right thing, no matter what the cost? How could he make his sparrows powerful enough to challenge the sparrow hawk of the Mughal Empire and win? Emperor Aurangzeb was a tyrant who used his faith to justify his political and religious persecution of others. His empire was the richest global economy in the late 17th century by some distance, and he actively sought out wars against smaller kingdoms in order to crush them. Anyone who didn't agree with him was either imprisoned or killed, and having survived several assassination attempts, he thought of himself divinely blessed and invincible. Sikhs suffered great persecution under the Mughals. However, the 10th Guru's method of dealing with Aurangzeb wasn't to cower away, but to challenge his authority. On the day of Vaisakhi in 1699, the Guru established the Khalsa, the Order of the Pure Ones. He could understand the tough days to come, and he wanted his Sikhs to be brave enough to sacrifice everything in the name of truth and just living. Not only would the Khalsa defend the existence of the Sikh faith itself, it would protect the most vulnerable in society regardless of differences, and be willing to speak truth to power no matter the cost. The 10th Guru consolidated spiritual and political leadership under the Khalsa. He was a religious leader calling out tyranny in his time, and he was not afraid of the consequences or repercussions. The Mughal Empire may have seen its peak during Aurangzeb's reign, but his eventual passing hastened the empire's rapid decline as trust in its ability to look after its subjects had all but disappeared. At a time when the world seems filled with individuals who wield sometimes inconceivable amounts of power, it is worth remembering the hubristic actions of past leaders. No one remains powerful forever. This too shall pass.
That was Thought for the Day with Jasveer Singh. It's now 10 to 8.
In the last few hours, the US has started blockading Iranian Gulf ports, trying to stop vessels from exporting its oil in retaliation for Iran's shutdown of the vast majority of global shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, which has seen prices soar as a result of that flow of oil and liquefied natural gas being impeded. Well, the UN's maritime agency, the International Maritime Organization, has said that no country has a legal right to block shipping in straits used for international transit. Arsenio Dominguez is its Secretary General, and he's been telling me it's a dangerous precedent to set.
In accordance to international law, no country has the right to blockade a strait that is used for international navigation.
And when you say no country, obviously you mean Iran, but presumably you also mean the US as well.
This message is sent to any country that is actually going against what is established on international law, maritime law. And this applies both countries that have made any statements right now in relation to creating a blockade. I do understand that there is a conflict going on there, but there's still no legal basis in international law to actually take any actions to blockade a strait that is used for international navigation.
And the tit-for-tat nature of this must concern you.
Absolutely. The message has been very clear from the beginning that de-escalation and diplomacy is the way forward. The more that this conflict continues and these kind of retaliatory measures takes place, the more concern that grows for the 20,000 seafarers that are still trapped in the Persian Gulf. And of course, everybody else around the world that continues to be impacted economically.
Is there anybody anywhere, any organisation, yours, somebody else that has the ability to actually try and change the situation here, that has the authority to try and forbid those countries from doing what they're doing?
That's why the United Nations was established 80 years ago. And it's several agencies, it's not just one, that has a remit and continues to engage all together to find a solution. But we need the compromises and we need the diplomacy from the countries as well. And those that are not directly involved in the conflict, but do have a say because they also being affected. So this is a global effort in order to bring peace to the region and to allow shipping to continue to operate the way that we're used to.
And the impact, and we've talked about this already, but the impact that this is having already is huge. What further impact do you expect because of the US blockade?
The longer this goes, the longer that we all will feel this impact. The 20,000 plus seafarers that we have trapped in the Strait of Hormuz, we've seen how global prices in relation to food security as well as energy, it's growing because we depend on the 20% of oil, 90% of gas, 13% of chemicals and fertilizers for food that actually comes from this region. Only shipping has the means to transport those goods in bulk cargoes. So the reality is that even using all the means of transportation is not going to be able to meet the global demands.
Even if this ended tomorrow, how long would that backlog take to clear?
The first thing for us will be to start working on the evacuation of all those seafarers that are trapped in there. But it will take some time for shipping and, of course, all the logistics to start going back into place. But the sooner that the conflict comes to an end, the sooner that we can start actually working to bring things to normality in shipping.
Who is actually looking after those seafarers at the moment? Does anybody have the ability to reach those stranded ships to deliver supplies in any way?
It's a combined effort and I maintain close cooperations with all the countries in the regions in the Persian Gulf that are actually taking actions in providing the necessary supplies and assistance to the seafarers. But it's also other organizations like the International Transport and Working Federations and countries of the nationalities of the seafarers and ship owners and ship operators. They maintain distant communications with them, provide assistance, support, etc. But we still need to de-escalate in order to do things right.
Do you feel that Iran and the US are listening to you? Your message is a strong one, but it risks being ignored.
I will continue to reiterate this message, and we cannot just back down. We need to bring more engagement and more multilateralism. And within my remit at the International Maritime Organization, I'm constantly having conversations with the countries involved in the conflict and all the other countries, members of IMO, that also have a say in what this conflict is, how this conflict is affecting us all.
Arsenio Dominguez, the Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Frank Gardner is our security correspondent. Frank, we've got a situation, and we've been here before, where the UN is saying, don't do this, this is against international law, and it doesn't seem like anybody's listening.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of chest-beating exercise going on here with both sides trying to see who's going to blink first. Sorry about all the mixed metaphors there, but, you know, this is really a test of wills. And Iran has shown in the last 6 weeks that it is able to absorb an enormous amount of pain, both militarily and economically. I think the US will be hoping that this may be what finally forces them to comply with what they want. Now, you know, we hear that in Islamabad they were close to some kind of agreement on a nuclear thing. That's not been confirmed, but there are reports coming out on that. And clearly the US is hoping to not only clear the Strait of Hormuz, but force Iran to comply with what it wants as guarantees to never build a nuclear weapon, something Iran says it was never going to do, and yet it has very suspiciously highly enriched this uranium to well beyond the levels you need for civil purposes. I think, and I just want to kind of clarify one thing that a lot of the media is making, I think, a little tiny mistake here. The US is not blockading the Strait of Hormuz, and I'm not saying we're saying this, but it's blockading Iranian ports. And that's going to sound like a slightly pedantic difference, but it's not impeding, or says it's not impeding, ships going through the Strait of Hormuz as long as they're not going to Iranian ports. But the effect is pretty similar. And, you know, as you heard there, you've got 20,000 seafarers stuck on the Gulf side of the Strait of Hormuz.
You'll be pleased to hear, Frank, that having seen your briefing note, that is exactly what we said at the start of this item. I took notice of what you had to say. And thank you, as always, Frank Gardner, there, our security correspondent.
How has history shaped classical music?
Of course, it often happens in history that changes in music come with changes in society.
From the birth of musical notation to the digital streaming revolution, join me, Gillian Moore, and leading experts, including Michael Wood, for an epic journey through 1,000 years of classical music.
What a miracle it is that we can still listen to music from so long ago.
Key Changes, Radio 3's essential history of classical music. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini. Morning.
Good morning, Anna. Bit of an east-west split going on this morning. For central and eastern areas, it's a chilly. It's been a frosty start to the day, but there's plenty of brightness and sunshine around. Meanwhile, towards western areas, particularly out towards southwest England, it's a lot milder, 10 degrees Celsius here to start the day. Plenty of cloud. That's also the case across Northern Ireland. Some patchy outbreaks of rain. And that weather front is going to be pushing further northwards and eastwards as we head throughout the day. So eventually, we'll all be seeing that cloud. So for Northern Ireland, Wales, southwest England, little change. It's very overcast, some hill and some coastal fog, but a patchy rain, fresh to locally strong southerly to southeasterly winds. Central and western Scotland gradually clouding over as we head throughout the day, despite that bright early start. That's also true across many parts of England as well. So there will be some patchy rain at times, a bit heavier towards the west. For southeast England and for northern and eastern Scotland, then I think we'll keep those brighter skies well into the afternoon, and it will feel a bit warmer than it did yesterday for most of us because we've got that southerly to southeasterly wind. So 11 to 15 Celsius for most. We could get to 16 or 17 degrees in central and eastern England. And then tonight we're buried underneath those layers of cloud, so it's going to be a lot milder. There are more weather fronts too that are edging in from the west, pushing eastwards, and tomorrow we'll see some heavier rain, particularly later on through the day, but also some sunshine and a bit warmer too.
Thanks very much indeed, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Glasgow and Nick Robinson. Well, no, she's in Salford and I'm in Glasgow.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 14th of April. The headlines this morning, a former Labour Defence Secretary, Lord Robertson, has attacked government spending on the armed forces. He'll say in a speech that there's corrosive complacency and that Britain can't be protected with an ever-expanding welfare budget.
The US Vice President, J.D. Vance, says there was progress during talks with Iran at the weekend, but he's accused the country of economic terrorism by blocking the Strait of Hormuz. And the police watchdog is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force, including a commander, over their handling of an inquiry into a crash which killed two children at a school in Wimbledon.
And after the news, the Southport inquiry highlighted the catastrophic failures by multiple agencies to stop the tragedy. Should those organisations face punishment for lack of action? The lawyer representing the families of the three girls who died certainly thinks so.
And I know the names of those people. I know the names of the people who failed, and I will state them publicly if need to.
And with elections to the Scottish Parliament just over 3 weeks away, what do voters make of the campaign so far?
For working class families, we're in a worse position than we've ever been, so there's nobody fighting our corner here.
It feels that way.
It feels that way, absolutely, yeah.
They talk as if they're trying to help you.
Yeah. No, you just don't see it.
We conclude our round of interviews with Scotland's party leaders by speaking to the leader of Scottish Labour and why we all need to keep looking up to the sky to see more beautiful sights. That's all after the BBC News read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
A former Labour cabinet minister who last year carried out a major review of the UK's armed forces has mounted a scathing attack on the government's handling of defence. Lord Robertson, who served as NATO Secretary General, will use a speech to warn of a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. The former Defence Secretary under Tony Blair will also warn about the impact of the expanding welfare budget on defence funding, claiming the UK's national security is in peril. Here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
Lord Robertson oversaw Labour's comprehensive review of defence policy that was published last year. But the investment plan to fund that vision has since been repeatedly delayed. Now, in a significant intervention, Lord Robertson will accuse what he calls non-military experts in the Treasury of vandalism. We are underprepared. We are underinsured. We are under attack. We are not safe, he will say in a speech today. Britain's national security and safety is in peril. There has been deadlock in government over the defence investment plan. The Prime Minister has said it is on his desk and he will resolve the matter. But with the Ministry of Defence already facing a reported £28 billion funding shortfall, there are questions over where the extra money would come from. Lord Robertson will say, "We cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget." A government spokesperson said the Strategic Defence Review was backed by the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War, and the investment plan would be published as soon as possible.
General Sir Richard Barons is a former commander of Joint Forces Command and was one of the authors of the Strategic Defence Review. He told us the Prime Minister needed to act quickly on the review's findings.
That SDR programme needs another £28 billion in the first 4 years to be affordable. And the choice that's on the Prime Minister's desk is they either find more money to implement this, in my view, de minimis review at the speed we agreed last year, or he's going to announce £28 billion worth of cuts. And how would that fit with the world that we find ourselves in today?
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused the Iranian government of engaging in an act of economic terrorism by stopping ships from using the Strait of Hormuz. Speaking to Fox News, he said President Trump had shown that two could play at that game. Yesterday, the US began its own blockade of Iranian ports. Mr. Vance, who led the negotiation team during talks with Iran at the weekend, said there had been progress despite the failure to reach an agreement. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
J.D. Vance said if the Iranians engaged in economic terrorism over the Strait of Hormuz, the US would abide by the same principle and make sure none of the country's ships got out of Iran either. He accused Tehran of moving the goalposts during talks at the weekend, saying that he'd expected the Iranians to fully reopen the strait in return for a ceasefire. He insisted that both sides had made some progress in the negotiation, but that it was now up to Iran to make the next move. The ball, he said, was very much in their court.
Talks between Lebanese and Israeli ambassadors to the US are expected to take place in Washington later. It will be the first time in decades that officials from the two countries, which don't have diplomatic relations, meet face-to-face for direct negotiations. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell.
The US top diplomat Marco Rubio is expected to join these rare direct talks at the State Department. They come just days after the US and Iran failed to reach an agreement to end the broader Middle East war. The Lebanese and Israeli ambassadors are due to discuss the possibility of higher-level direct talks between their countries. The Lebanese authorities first want to broker a ceasefire in Israel's ongoing war with Hezbollah. However, Israel has ruled that out, insisting that the Iran-backed group must be disarmed. And Hezbollah has rejected the talks and said it won't abide by anything that's agreed. The latest fighting between Israel and Hezbollah has been devastating for Lebanon. More than 1 million people have been displaced and more than 2,000 killed, including about 500 women, children and medical workers.
The head of the International Energy Agency says the current level of energy prices do not reflect the severity of the problem in the Gulf. Fatih Birol was speaking as leading finance figures, including the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, arrived in Washington for the International Monetary Fund's spring meetings. The police watchdog, the IOPC, is investigating 11 officers from the Metropolitan Force over its response to a fatal crash at a South London school in 2023. Two 8-year-old children, Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau, died after a Land Rover hit an end-of-term tea party at the Study Preparatory School in Wimbledon. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
When the police carried out its first investigation into the Wimbledon school crash, it ended with the driver, Claire Fremantle, facing no charges, as prosecutors said she'd had an undiagnosed epileptic seizure. The parents of Nuria Sajjad and Selina Lau always said the investigation was flawed and it was reopened in 2024. The police watchdog will examine the way it was carried out, including allegations that race was a factor in the way officers treated the girls' families and if the police gave false information to them. Four serving police officers, including a commander and a former officer, are being investigated for possible gross misconduct. The Metropolitan Police said it would provide every assistance to the police watchdog. The parents of Nuria and Selina told the BBC that while they are encouraged by the IOPC investigation, the truth must come to light. Prosecutors now have a full file of evidence from the police. The families are waiting for them to decide on charges.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has called on the Vatican to stick to matters of morality after Donald Trump heavily criticised the Pope. Mr. Trump refused to apologise for calling Leo XIV weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. The Pope had condemned the war against Iran. Mr. Trump has also faced criticism for a now-deleted social media post which depicted the president as a Jesus-like figure. Donald Trump claimed it was meant to be him as a doctor. The English Cardinal Timothy Radcliffe, who took part in the conclave that elected the Pope, told Newsnight he was right to challenge Mr. Trump's actions.
For the first time for a long time, the great powers of the world openly seek to seize power nakedly by violence. I think that the Pope has a duty to speak out against anybody who promotes war in this way.
The founder of China's biggest property development company, Evergrande, has pleaded guilty to a number of charges, including embezzlement of corporate assets and corporate bribery. Hui Kaiyan, formerly China's richest man, presided over the firm as it accumulated hundreds of billions of pounds of debt. There's a warning from school leaders that girls from white, low-income families are being overlooked in efforts to tackle the underachievement of working-class children in England. Hayley Mortimer reports.
Overall, the proportion of boys in England passing English and maths GCSEs has increased slightly since 2019. This includes boys who are eligible for free school meals. But the reverse is true for girls, with a 3.5 percentage point drop amongst those considered disadvantaged and an even bigger fall amongst low-income white British girls. Just 38% of this group achieved a grade 4 or above in English and maths last year. Teachers say there needs to be a national conversation about how to better support these young women.
The Department for Education has said it is radically reforming the way funding for disadvantaged groups is given to schools to make sure the system is better for children. A record 6 British artists are to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in November. They are Oasis, Phil Collins, Sade, Billy Idol and Iron Maiden, together with Joy Division and New Order, who are being treated as one group. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
The inductees were announced during last night's edition of the TV talent show American Idol, a somewhat incongruous setting when the list included the famously gloomy Manchester band Joy Division. Phil Collins is now in for his solo work, having already been accepted as a member of Genesis. Your love is key. Sade is the first ever black British woman to be included. Iron Maiden and Billy Idol are both to be honoured. While it will be interesting to see if Oasis turn up to the ceremony in November, Liam Gallagher had previously said about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he didn't need an award from a geriatric in a cowboy hat.
Colin Patterson reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It is 11 minutes past 8 now. There are few things in life as devastating as losing a child. To know that that death could have been prevented brings a whole new level of pain and grief. On the 29th of July 2024, just a few days into the school summer holidays, Alistair Silva Aguirre, Elsie Dot Stancombe and BB King were at a Taylor Swift-themed dance class. Nobody in the room that day had ever heard of Axel Rudikubana or knew anything about his capacity for violence. But other people did. His mum and dad, the police, and various authorities whose job it was to keep the public safe from him. All of them, we now know, failed to do that. The three girls' parents have already responded to the killing of their daughters with quiet dignity and spoke about their young lives to the BBC documentary Our Girls, The Southport Families.
We want her to be remembered for the child she was and not what happened to her.
We got to do this for Alice. We got to keep her light on.
Elsie will not be defined by what happened on that day. She was so much more.
Well, those families are now coming to terms with the fact that their children could still have been alive today, had the agencies involved carried out their role properly, and had the killer's parents sought an intervention before their son committed murder. At the first phase of the public inquiry into the Southport attacks yesterday, its chair, Sir Adrian Fulford, was unequivocal in his findings.
I have no doubt that if appropriate procedures had been in place and if sensible steps had been taken by the agencies and AR's parents, this dreadful event would not have happened. It could have been and it should have been prevented.
Over 760 pages, the report on the events of that terrible day and the mistakes made in the years that preceded it are laid out in heartbreaking detail. The aim now is to make sure that nothing like it ever happens again. Well, I've been speaking to Chris Walker, the lawyer who represents the families of Alice, Elsie and Bibi.
They continue to live in a horror movie. Every time there's a new report, every time there's a new statement, their families go through the traumatization of that event yet again. Right now, they are going through that whole episode again, reliving the whole event. We heard in great detail during the inquiry all of the failures. So the report in itself is not a surprise. We've been working together with the families, my team and I, discussing the failures as they arise. But at this moment in time, it's very difficult for them to comprehend because they are still living in this horror movie. It's very difficult for them to understand and comprehend the enormity of the proposed changes, which have to take place.
Let's break it down. Before we look at what needs to happen in the future to stop an event like this from ever happening again, if we look back at what happened that day, there have been numerous failings, the various agencies involved, the killer's parents. Now, they have been identified in this report, but for you and for them, that is not the end.
No, there are several layers of failings here. There's gaps in the law, the legal process, the legal framework, which we are engaged with. And I'm relatively pleased on a personal level of the proposed changes from the framework of the legal process, which will be discussed in great detail in phase two. Thereafter, there is the failure of the individual local agencies, Prevent, Lancashire Police, Lancashire Social Services, CAMS, FCAMS, to implement the processes which were already in place. And then thereafter, there are individual failings from the agencies to an appalling level, in my view. And of course, there is also the failings of the parents. I said in the moments after the inquiry concluded, the oral evidence of the inquiry concluded, that the apology that we heard on that day was rejected by the families. And I called for them personally to be incarcerated for the lack of foresight, lack of preventing the attack. I firmly believe that that's correct. But I'm also firmly of the belief that this report should not be regarded as the AR's failings report. Equally culpable are the individual failings and the systemic failings of those agencies which I mentioned.
So you think there should be individual criminal accountability here?
There should be individual criminal accountability for the parents. I accept that the law and the legal process which we currently have, it makes that very difficult. And I know one of the recommendations within the report is to change that, which is pleasing. But thereafter, I wrote several months ago to those agencies I mentioned requesting disciplinary proceedings. That includes the senior managers and also the people at the coalface.
And what kind of replies did you get to that?
The predominant replies at the moment is we need to wait until the inquiry report is out. It is now out. I will be revisiting that with them all individually. And consequently, if those disciplinary proceedings have not concluded to our satisfaction, then I know the names of those people. I know the names of the people who failed, and I will state them publicly if need to. And I'll also rehash the failures and go through it all in a public environment so that the world will know of their failings.
So that is something that you will continue to press for. As you said, this is the first phase of the inquiry. Phase two will focus a lot more on how the law needs to change, how to stop something like this from happening again. But you know, and I know, and we all know, there have been so many public inquiries before and results published, and people say lessons will be learned, lessons have been learned. And yet these tragedies, whatever they may be, happen again. So how do you, and how do the families, as you say, living every day with that devastation, how do you make sure this doesn't become one of those inquiries where lessons are learned, but then they aren't?
That is very much the point. It's very clear that every so often we lurch from disaster to disaster. We lurch from inquiry to inquiry. The recommendations seem to be the same in terms of state failings, silo of work, failure to pass on information to different agencies. One of the recommendations is within the report is a lead agency. That leaps off the page is something which is necessary. We have to ensure that the recommendations are implemented. But you have to also be aware that the report was almost 800 pages. It's a very detailed report. We're grateful for that. But we received the report at 8 a.m. yesterday. Consequently, the piecing together of the jigsaw is still under review, and we are still analysing that. Whilst there are a number of recommendations within that report which we feel are broadly positive, once we've done the analysis of piecing it all together to have a look at what that means, then we will be able to comment further upon that in the ensuing few days and weeks.
That is Chris Walker, the lawyer who represents the Southport families. Let's also speak to Stephanie Roberts-Bibby, who's Chief Executive of the Youth Justice Board. Good morning.
Good morning.
You also contributed to the public inquiry. Just talk us through. People will be shocked and alarmed and disappointed at the number of failings that happened in relation to the killer. He was known to the police. He was known to the local authority. He was known in the court system. What went wrong in that none of these things were picked up? Why wasn't he stopped when he was known to so many people? His capacity for violence was so well known.
Good morning, Anna, and to your listeners too. I also just want to start by offering my sincere condolences on behalf of myself, the organisation I lead, the Youth Justice Board, and to give a commitment that we will do all we can to make sure that the lessons are learnt and as quickly as possible. It is very clear, isn't it, from the very first recommendation in the Chair's report for Part 1 that there is a need for a single agency to be able to hold responsibility in instances like this. And we very much look forward to working through with Phase 2 of the inquiry to see how that might come to life. It is clear in this instance that there was lots of information about the perpetrator that was known to a number of professionals, but not one person had a helicopter view of what was happening with him at any given time.
Do you think there was enough professional curiosity from those individuals who knew what was happening? Because it might sound strange to people who don't work in that industry that no person, no individual would see what was going on and choose to try and take that kind of responsibility.
I made this point in my evidence around professional curiosity and the importance of professionals really leaning in and understanding what's happening in this instance with the perpetrator and the family to know what's going on, what behaviours are being demonstrated, and then how best do we mitigate and manage whether those in the event that harm would be caused. Lots of people talk about resources and professional curiosity costs nothing. However, we should also accept that no one in our public services goes to work to do a bad job. Everyone goes to work to make a difference and to do the best they can. So, I think the Chair reflected this very articulately yesterday, that people were doing what they could do with the information that was there. However, there is clear, isn't it, that everyone could have and should have done more.
Do you think there were elements that got in the way of that? Things like the killer's diagnosis of autism, things like his ethnicity. Did those things make people stand back when they shouldn't have done?
I think there is a challenge for us in all elements of public service delivery, if when we attribute a label or a diagnosis to an individual, that we can be clouded in our judgment about attributing behaviours to that rather than dealing with the behaviour itself. So I think there is definitely, in this case, evidence that the perpetrator's potential diagnosis and then actual diagnosis meant that people were attributing his behaviours to his autism. And I want to be really clear on this point. Autism is not a predictor of risk, but it certainly appears a real challenge to the professionals that were working with him and his family at the time.
From a youth justice perspective, there were real failings with the referral order that he was given. And again, you gave evidence about this at the inquiry. There should have been reparative work involved in that, which didn't seem to happen. You described the objectives set by the referral order as very, very limited, which was accepted and endorsed in the final report. Are referral orders overall, would you say, fit for purpose? Was this an isolated incident or do they need to be looked at again?
So I think there's definitely a place for reviewing and reconsidering the referral order guidance in the light of the report. However, I think they are fit for purpose if they are used as intended and if the plan that is set for each child meets the child's needs and risk of harm to self and others. And that needed to be much, much more resilient and robust in this instance.
Stephanie Roberts-Beebe, the Chief Executive of the Youth Justice Board. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It is now 23 minutes past eight. How will people who are disappointed and angry with those who govern them, who are scared about the future, use their vote in next month's big election? I'm in Glasgow this morning for the biggest week so far of one of the biggest elections in this election cycle, the election for the Scottish Parliament. I'm here in the week when many will be able to vote by post. And they'll have six big parties to choose from in what has become a crowded political field. This is also the week when Scotland's two traditionally big parties launched their manifesto, starting yesterday with the Labour Party.
It is my privilege to welcome your next First Minister, Anna Sarwar.
The man who wants to be Scotland's next First Minister is desperate to inject energy, passion, belief into a largely lifeless election campaign. His message,
Scotland needs change. It should be an easy one to land. After all, Scotland has an unpopular government seeking a fifth term in a third decade in power. After all, there have been a series of scandals that have hit the SNP. And yet this man, who is high-fiving the audience as he marches in to his manifesto launch, was once odds-on favourite to win. Now he faces a massive uphill struggle.
They have had 20 years, so give me five and I will show that we can once again have an NHS that is true to its founding principles, there when you need it.
It's more than two decades since the SNP came to power, back in 2005. That's before the iPhone was even invented. And since the last Holyrood election, the party's confronted crisis after crisis after crisis.
I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
Peter Murrell arriving home tonight after more than 9 hours in custody at Falkirk Police Station.
Three large ferries, including its two newest vessels, are unavailable while faults are investigated. Four other ships are away for annual maintenance.
After first Nicola Sturgeon and then Humza Yousaf were forced to quit as Scotland's First Minister, the veteran John Swinney came to his party's rescue, having only recently himself quit frontline politics after almost 16 years as a minister in various Scottish governments. Independence is the cause of Swinney's life. Yesterday, on a visit to Oban on the west coast, he tried to link the crisis in the Middle East and soaring energy bills with the need for Scotland to go its own way.
The fact that Scotland's energy resources are powering so much of our economy, but we're not receiving the benefit of that for people in Scotland.
The leader of the Scottish National Party, Alex Salmond, has announced his resignation after failing to gain independence for Scotland.
I think the party, parliament and country would benefit from new leadership.
It is almost a dozen years since the referendum on Scottish independence. Swinney hopes to unite all pro-independent Scots in a call for another vote. He's got the backing of the SNP's former partners in government, the Scottish Greens. Their co-leader is Gillian Mackay.
It's really nice to meet you.
Hello. She campaigned yesterday at a nursery.
There's a train going to England. Oh my goodness.
Starting school at seven would be better for children because that play-based environment is how they learn better at that age.
The SNP are helped by the fact that the other side of the great divide in Scottish politics, the backers of the union, are divided four ways. Between Labour, the Tories...
Hey, are we pointing at it or...
Their leader, Russell Finlay, was pledging to fill in potholes yesterday.
We've got a plan to fix Scotland's potholes, to ensure that dangerous potholes like the ones we see here today are filled in and that our roads are made safe.
And the Lib Dems, whose leader is Alex Cole Hamilton, he invited the cameras, somewhat unusually, to join him while he walked his dog.
You want a tummy tickle? Tummy tickle.
We need to back teachers up with legislation that says when they're in class, they need to be mobile phone free.
And fourth, but not least, the new force in Scottish politics, one that would have been unthinkable just a while back.
Good evening, Aberdeen!
Reform UK had no members of the Scottish Parliament a year ago, no leader in Scotland just 3 months ago. Nigel Farage was widely derided as an English nationalist. But now, in some polls, his party is placed second.
The campaign's fully on, and I can't think of anywhere symbolically more important for Scotland, the United Kingdom, right now, given the events of the Middle East, than Aberdeen.
A lot of my friends are looking at reform now.
Does that surprise you? I think a couple of years ago, the thought of Scots voting for Nigel Farage would have seemed really quite surprising.
A lot of people that I know are big on immigration at the minute. That seems to be the defining factor.
Here you can see the most amount of penguins, OK? As they're swimming, you might even come really close to the windows.
It's the last week of the Easter holidays at Edinburgh Zoo, and Penguins Rock in particular is packed with noisy kids looking at sometimes noisy animals, and their mums and dads seem to prefer them both to all too often noisy politicians.
You know, for working class families, we're in a worse position than we've ever been, so there's nobody fighting our corner here.
It feels that way.
It feels that way, absolutely, yeah.
They talk as if they're trying to help you.
Yeah. No, you just don't see it.
And this is a treat, a day out of the zoo.
Absolutely. It's his birthday today.
Happy birthday. But does it also feel budgets are tight?
You know, it's actually come prepared, you know. We've got that lunch with us today, you know, because you do have to be more money savvy.
Will you vote?
No, I don't know.
Why? Why do you hate... You obviously, you don't like them.
They're a bunch of idiots.
What, the politicians here in Edinburgh?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Do you care who's going to run the government in Scotland next?
Very much so, yes. I'm quite keen on Scottish independence, even though I'm English.
So the big issue for you in this election is still independence, is it?
It's not the major one, perhaps, at the moment, but it's certainly still a consideration, yes.
Back at Labour's manifesto launch, one veteran watcher of Scottish politics says the unpopularity of the Westminster government seems, for now, to have trumped the unpopularity of the Scottish government.
Paul Hutchin and the political editor of the Daily Record. I think if politics was normal in Scotland, Labour would be headed for a victory on May the 7th, because what you've got is an SNP government that is struggling on a range of fronts, and yet opinion polls show Labour are in line for a historic defeat. And I think there's no doubt that Scottish Labour are being punished for the sins and the record of Keir Starmer. That is the key dynamic in this election contest so far, and it's something that Anas Sarwar is really struggling with.
Vote for change, says Labour's Scottish leader, but that is exactly what Keir Starmer said in the general election. And ever since, people have seen the change, or perhaps the lack of it, that has come from Westminster, Labour have struggled to look like winners here.
And Nick Willett completes his set of political interviews in about 10 minutes or so. He'll be speaking to Anas Sarwar, the leader of Scottish Labour. It is 28 minutes to nine now. It's time for the sport. Carthy's back.
Morning. Thank you very much. A massive result for Leeds United last night. A 2-1 win over Manchester United in the Premier League. Leeds are 6 points clear of the relegation zone after a first league win at Old Trafford since 1981. Attention turns to the Champions League tonight, with Arne Slot's Liverpool needing to overturn a 2-0 deficit against Paris Saint-Germain in the return leg of their quarter-final. And England women face World Cup champions Spain tonight at Wembley in a World Cup qualifier. Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland also have qualifiers. There are full details of those on the BBC Sport website. Now, I have a copy in front of me of the 2026 Wisden Cricketers Almanac. It's in the studio with me, along with the editor of the famous Yellow Book, Lawrence Booth. Morning.
Good morning, Cathy.
Your traditional editor's notes don't hold back this year. There are various elements that I want to try and get into as quickly as we can. And I have to start with feckless, reckless and legless, your damning description of the England team after their 4-1 Ashes series defeat to Australia. Have you taken any positives from the director of men's cricket at the ECB, Rob Key's interviews recently admitting there were flaws in the preparation and poor decision-making in their performances?
Not a huge amount. I mean, a lot of things that Rob Key has said since the Ashes were things that a lot of pundits were saying before the Ashes. So it almost feels like they're a few months behind the loop, and in that time England have lost the Ashes 4-1. I mean, the big challenge now for English cricket and for Key to sort out is can Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes work together again in the positive way that sort of seemed to fall away during the Ashes after England went 2-0 down at Brisbane? They went in separate directions. One of the great strengths of that, of the Bazball regime, they hate the phrase, but one of the great strengths previously had been that they were singing from the same hymn sheet. There were signs in Australia that they weren't. They've given these guys the chance to dig England out of the hole that they created. Let's see what happens.
OK, there's a lot more to go into on that, but we have talked about it a lot before on the programme. Wisden's men's leading cricketer of the year is Mitchell Starc. One of the elements of the new Wisden is always the announcement of your five cricketers of the year. India dominate that list, and the only domestic player is the Nottinghamshire captain, Haseeb Hameed. Why was he chosen?
Yeah, it's always nice to give someone from the domestic game one of the awards. He captained Nottinghamshire to their first county championship title in 15 years, so a big moment for the club. And he led the way with run scoring over 1,250 runs at an average of 66, carried his bat twice, converted two of his four centuries into doubles. So a nice choice there.
And I mentioned there's quite a lot in your editorial notes. You described the private investment of the 100 with its new ownership structure as risking turning the tournament into an IPL proxy event. I suppose part of the counter-argument to that would be the financial impact is partly to help grassroots cricket and county cricket. What are your major concerns about that investment and the way it's been done?
I think when you look around franchise tournaments around the world, a lot of them have become IPL proxy events, so they are an extension of sort of India's dominance of the game. That in itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's how the money is used. Will the counties be able to access that money properly? We're talking about $25 million possibly for the non-host counties. These are life-changing amounts, but it has to be accessed in the first place with a good business plan. Then it has to be spent well. And then one day it will run out. And we haven't yet discussed the scenario when the money goes. We'll have given away the whole of August to a non-county event. England won't play as much Test cricket in August. So there are there's lots of potential collateral damage from what's happened. So we'll have to watch this space closely.
Okay, we'll come back to that probably at another point. There's a report also in Wisden about state school cricket in the UK. What can be done to address the balance of state private school cricketers coming through the system?
The ECB are aware of this. They launched their state school action plan in 2024. This year we've got the Knight-Stokes Cup. Heather Knight and Ben Stokes both went to state schools. So 820 state schools have applied to play the finals day at Lords. That's a fifth of all the state schools in the country. We're moving in the right direction, but we're still a long way from where we need to be if cricket's going to be truly representative.
OK, Lawrence Booth, there's plenty in there. Lot of other topics as well, including the incarceration of Imran Khan. There's a lovely celebration of Dickie Bird's life and also cricket's links with the mining community. So plenty to read when Wisden comes out on Thursday.
Cathy, thank you very much indeed. Sorry, just if you're hearing Anna Sarr in the background, we're going to be talking to him in just a few minutes' time here in Glasgow. But let's look ahead now to what's coming up here on Radio 4 with Jim Al-Khalili.
Hello, my guest today is Dr. Seth Barclay, an epidemiologist whose career has been shaped by one key theme. Vaccines save lives, but only if people can get them. His work has taken him around the world, from helping to build Uganda's HIV surveillance system and leading Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, to founding COVAX, the initiative designed to stop wealthy nations monopolising COVID-19 vaccines during the pandemic. I'll be talking to Seth about his globe-trotting career, from saving millions of young lives through vaccination distribution to setting his own shattered leg after a climbing accident in Namibia. On The Life Scientific, after the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
The weather today sees a bit of sunshine in the east to start, but it'll be cloudy for all of us later with spells of rain.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Nick Robinson in Glasgow at 23 minutes to 9. Here's a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
A former Labour cabinet minister who last year carried out a root and branch review of the armed forces has mounted a scathing attack on the government's handling of defence. Lord Robertson, who also served as NATO Secretary General, will warn in a speech of a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. There's been deadlock in government over its defence investment plan, although the Prime Minister has said he will resolve the matter. The former head of Joint Forces Command, General Sir Richard Barons, told us that if the plan wasn't implemented, the armed forces would in effect face £28 billion of cuts. Ministers insist they've carried out the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War. The US Vice President J.D. Vance says there was progress during talks with Iran at the weekend. The Reuters news agency says it's been told by multiple sources that American and Iranian teams will return to Pakistan for peace talks later this week. The lawyer representing the families of the three girls killed in the knife attack at a dance class in Southport has told this programme that he's willing to publicly name the people from organisations who failed to prevent the tragedy. In 2024, Axel Rudikabana killed Alistair Silva Aguiar, Elsie Dot Stancombe and B.B. King. Yesterday, the first phase of a public inquiry found catastrophic failures by multiple agencies.
Thank you, Jane. It's 22 minutes to 9. Iran's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has had a huge impact on the global economy since it halted the vast majority of global shipping there when the war began just over 6 weeks ago now. But one thing which had continued was the flow of Iranian oil, nearly 60 million barrels departing from the main Kharg Island terminal, most of it heading for China. And now the US tit-for-tat blockage has already shown the first signs of impeding that, several vessels turning back when faced with US warships. So how is Beijing likely to react? Well, Dr. Yu Ji is with us, Senior Research Fellow on China in the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
This is a lot of oil heading to China. They will doubtless be unhappy if it stops. What diplomatic effect is that likely to provoke?
Well, obviously, as what we have seen so far, what Xi Jinping responded this morning by saying, well, the world has turned into disarray, and certainly that is the case for the Chinese economy as well. I mean, last month, Beijing has offered overall assessment that the China's economic growth this year will only lasting about 4.5%, which is lowest in the three decade, and in the way factored into the ripple effects of this war in Iran and how this affected Chinese economy. And also, let's think about the Chinese economy as being very much export-oriented. So it's largely depending on the raw material, and it's largely depending on global connectivities. Now, these two factors has been hugely disrupted by this war. So China is outrightly to be concerned.
And when Beijing is deciding how to respond, will it lean diplomatically, or is there a possibility, as we've seen other nations do, get involved militarily?
Well, I think primarily from Beijing's end, it would more prefer to involve diplomatically. Whatever Beijing does when it comes to diplomacy, it always prioritizes the U.S.-China relations. Now, at the moment, I think Beijing's responses to this war seems to be very timid. That is to say, Beijing does not equally want to irritate President Trump himself, because this is going to be an up visit by President Trump to Beijing, and then there's plenty to discuss about, and hence it will be the best to hold off to making any move until the leadership summit between US and China take place.
Yeah, there's lots of important dates in the calendar, isn't there? Dr. Yu Ji, thank you for joining us. Sean Farrington's back as well on the topic of oil, because Sean, an interesting update from BP this morning.
Yeah, the oil giant has said it's now set for an exceptional oil trading result in the first 3 months of the year because of the higher oil price. So you look at the refining part of the BP's business, and it says margins there are much bigger than previously expected, adding hundreds of millions of dollars in profits. We'll get the full numbers towards the end of the month, but it's a reminder, when the oil price stays so much higher for longer. We look at BP saying that the average price of Brent crude in the first 3 months of the year was over $81 a barrel. The previous 3 month period, it was $64 a barrel. That higher oil price for oil producing companies around the world will lead to higher profits at the minute. And of course, it just brings into perspective a little bit where the profits are being made at the moment, and possibly politically, those questions around things like windfall taxes. Not all of these profits by any means at BP will have been made in the North Sea. In fact, a minority of their production is in the North Sea, where the windfall tax in the UK is applied. But just a reminder of why those conversations come up around the time of lengthy higher energy prices.
Yeah, and also economically, wars have losers, but they always have winners in there somewhere in the mix as well, don't they? Sean, thank you. Sean Farrington there with the latest on that.
It's now 18 minutes to nine. In the last 2 days, we've been speaking to each of the leaders of the major Scottish political parties in this big week for the election campaign. And we're joined now, I'm delighted to say, by the leader of the Scottish Labour Party, Anna Sawa. Morning to you, Mr.
Good morning, Nick. Good to have you in Glasgow.
Just heard your launch just a little way down the road in Edinburgh yesterday. I've got the manifesto in front of me. Scotland needs change, you say. Isn't the central problem for you in this campaign, which is voters have seen what the Labour Party means by change, it means Keir Starmer, and they don't much like it?
Well, Keir Starmer's not standing to be First Minister. I am. It's a straight choice between me and John Swinney in this election. And what I'm saying to people across the country is this election is not without consequence. It's not about protest. It's about what happens to our schools, our hospitals, what it means for our towns, cities, villages and islands. And having been in power for 2 years, are we honestly saying that we're going to give a free pass to a party that's been in power for 20 years? I don't think we can, I don't think we should, and I don't think we will.
But so it's a reasonable question for this reason, isn't it? Which is, if you go to the electorate and say, we want change, they're entitled to say, well, what did you mean last time you promised change and you backed Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister? And they'll say, well, we don't much like, many voters in Scotland are telling the pollsters, they tell me when I'm out and about, we don't like the cuts to the winter fuel, we don't like the cuts to the disability, we don't like the disappointment that Labour in power has been. So in what way are you saying you'll be different? So
I'll make 2 points. One is, I will always be proud of the fact that Scotland led the way of ridding this country of a Tory government that was doing so much damage. And I think everyone across Scotland will be happy that we got rid of the Tories. Have there been good things done by a UK Labour government? Yes. Do people feel a sense of disappointment? Yes, I share it.
Yeah. And well, let's remind people, the most notable thing you did in this campaign was to call Keir Starmer to quit.
Well, look, I said what I said. I stand by it. I don't recoil from it. But again, I make the point, this election is not about passing a judgment on a government that's been in for 2 years. It's about passing judgment on one that's been in for 20 years.
I hate you.
And the proposition I'm making in this election campaign is, you've given John Swinney and the SNP 20 years. Give me 5. And in the 5 years, I will demonstrate that we can make the NHS work, we can make life more affordable, and we can build a better future for our country, Scotland.
This is a very long manifesto. What, 90-odd pages? But, I mean, I've just been reading the Scottish newspaper coverage, and almost every commentary says the same thing. It's awfully long, but it lacks a big idea. What it essentially says is, I'd run things pretty much as they are now, but better.
Well, look, it's full of ambition and it's full of big ideas. And as someone who worked in the NHS, fixing the NHS, modernising the NHS is personal to me, that is a big idea. So we will fix the NHS, make sure it's there when you need it, cut waiting lists, end the ATM rush for a GP, bring back the family doctor. We'll embrace technology. Many of your listeners in other parts of the UK will know you have access to an NHS app. You have much more digital technology involved in your NHS. We don't have that in Scotland. We would deliver that in Scotland so you get faster treatment, faster diagnosis. We'll build 125,000 new homes so we can bring down poverty. Yep. We have a record number of children in homelessness in Scotland right now. We would address that and end rough sleeping.
But the competition
for all, and so much more.
Yes,
but I'll let you come
no,
back.
No, forgive me. Sorry, so much more, and there's a lot in here. I accept that. Here's the problem, though. You and John Swinney are competing, Labour and the SNP, to offer more goodies to the electorate. You can have more of this, you can have more of that. This is at a time when the Auditor General has said there is a £5 billion black hole in the budget of Scotland. This is backed up by every independent financial advisor. And that was before the war, before the energy crisis. Are you not in danger of being dishonest with people when, for example, you say, as you did yesterday, I will not raise your income tax for 5 years? You've no idea whether you'll have to raise taxes.
We will not increase income tax in the next 5 years. And the reason why is, right now, if you earn £33,500 in Scotland, you pay more tax above that than anywhere else in the UK. That's not fair. That's a doctor. That's a teacher. That's a nurse. That's not fair that they're paying higher taxes. But if you actually look at the IFS report that came out after our manifesto, we aren't making big free giveaway pledges. And the reason why is, I'm being upfront and honest with people, we've got to fix the mess. We've got to get the basics right. And over time, we've got to build that better future for our country. And that's why
the economy's getting a tougher backdrop, not an easier backdrop. Inflation is going up.
Well, of course, that's a risk, Nick, and no one can shy away from the fact that we have great global instability. And again, yesterday I set out what we would do, rather than just thinking the job of the First Minister is just to be a chief lobbyist to the UK. I will use the full force of the Scottish Government. I will use the Office of First Minister to take emergency action if this conflict continues and the stability continues. But, and that's a £100 million pound emergency package, including bailout loans, including grants for families, including bulk buy fuel.
You handing out more money.
But again, more detail. But again, that's loans and in some cases grants for lower-income households.
Let me ask you what I asked John
Swinney. Money then comes back to the government.
In the last hour, I put the same point to him. Now, he alluded to fact that there may have to be some public sector job losses. Shouldn't you, before this election is out, if you're not to repeat the disappointment that there was with Keir Starmer, say to voters, I know you want more. The answer is, you're going to get less, because there simply is not the money to do what the Scottish Government is doing already.
So the argument I would make there, Nick, is I think people in Scotland already feel like they're paying more and more and getting less and less. And the reason why is the money is not being spent on the right things. We've got layer after layer of bureaucracy and management. So I'm really open about it. We're going to cut the number of quangos. We're going to cut the number of managers and bureaucrats, and we're going to invest in the front line. We'll end the waste. For example, ferries costing £500 million that don't sail. A prison that was supposed to cost £100 million costing £1 billion under the SNP. We'll fix procurement. We'll save money. We'll cut people's taxes so we meet our growth target. But we're being honest, but also ambitious in this manifesto.
Now, just a couple of years ago, people used to come up to you and say, you're going to be our next First Minister. That was the expectation.
That's a judgment they'll make in the 7th of May.
One reason they are not saying that now, although you hope they're wrong, and of course it's the voters who will decide, is not just because of this argument about Labour's performance in Westminster, because of the emergence of Reform UK. Nigel Farage in Aberdeen last night, you in the Scottish political classes have derided him. You've accused his party of being racist. You say that his ideas don't have any place in Scotland. In some polls, he's ahead of you. Well, Nigel Farage, an English nationalist, he's ahead of the Labour Party in Scotland. What's going on?
Well, he accepts that he can't win this election in Scotland, and Lord Malcolm Offord can't be that great champion of working class communities. He wants to pretend to be being a former cheerleader for Margaret Thatcher and served in Boris and Liz Truss's government. This is a straight choice. Farage and Reform are noise in this election. They can only stop change. The only route to change is Scottish Labour on May the 7th, and that's the plea I make to people across the country. Let's transform our country. Let's not have those old fights, old debates. Let's fixate on what happens in Scotland. And I honestly believe if this election's about Scotland, people will vote for change on the 7th of May.
Anna Sawatt, Leader of Scottish Labour, thank you very
much. My absolute
indeed.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Now, I have a confession as a former political editor, rather obsessed with British general elections. In my report earlier on, I suggested that the SNP had taken power at the time of the UK general election in 2005, not the Holyrood election in 2007.
They've still had almost 20 though, Nick, so I think it's time they had a break and gave somebody else a chance.
Sorry for getting that wrong. Adesoa slipping in another party political broadcast there at the end. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, my pleasure.
It's 9 minutes to nine now. A BBC investigation has uncovered fresh, wide-ranging evidence that indicates Greek police have for years been recruiting migrants to force other migrants back across its river border with Turkey. So-called pushbacks are widely considered illegal under international law. The Greek Prime Minister's told the BBC he was totally unaware of the allegations. Our Europe correspondent Jessica Parker has the story. And just to warn you, her report does contain elements of violence that you might find upsetting.
Hi, we are all coming from Turkey.
A woman films herself in front of a group of migrants huddled under a tree.
We have women, children here.
It's June 2023. They're declaring that they've crossed the Evros River from Turkey into Greece and making an appeal.
Please don't push back us. Please accept us.
But later, there's panic. Masked men are running down a track towards them. A report by the EU Border Agency's independent investigator found that, on the available evidence, the masked men are migrants themselves, armed and acting under Greek police orders. Their job here? To force other migrants onto boats back to Turkey. This is a story about so-called mercenaries. Greece's northeastern region of Evros. Folk musicians busk in local cafes. It's a borderland, lying on the outer edge of the European Union. Tensions have flared here in the past, as Greece has long grappled with waves of refugees and illegal migration, including here on the Evros River.
Look to me. Look. Look. You. Look. Look.
Our investigation began when we obtained disturbing images via a smuggler disgruntled with his associates. In one video, an unseen man points a stick at men sat on the ground. Some are stripped, bleeding or bruised.
Look to me.
This video's unverified, but mirrors accounts we've gathered over months of migrants being robbed and beaten in a pushback operation where mercenaries work for Greek police. Near Paris Airport, we meet a Moroccan, who we're calling Marwan. He says he was recruited under duress to ferry migrants back to Turkey in 2020, plucked from a crowd of detained migrants by a Greek officer.
He told me, "You seem like a good guy and speak some English. Do you want to work with me?"
I felt forced to say yes, because I was afraid he would beat me.
What was the deal they offered you?
700 euros, papers to stay in Greece, and 3 mobile phones.
Marwan denies being violent to anyone, but says he witnessed the worst beatings down by the river.
The reason they beat them so much in that spot is to scare the migrants, so they won't try to come back to Greece again.
We're driving along a highway that's very close to Greece's eastern border with Turkey. Now and then, you can even catch glimpses of a grey border fence that marks where the River Evros runs. But we can't just go down to that fence or the river to see what's happening. It's a military zone. So we've had to find other ways of investigating this story. We've come to Turkey. I'm not going to say exactly where, because the woman we're meeting really wants to remain fully anonymous. But she says she was pushed back from Greece in 2025. That's despite having lodged an asylum claim. What's more, she has the paperwork and time-stamped photos that we've seen to prove that she made it to Greece before she says she was arrested with her family, with her children, in the street by a policeman, before being handed over to masked men who took her to the Evros River.
They were stripping and beating people.
As these men hunted for valuables, she recalls, the children were not spared.
My daughter was wearing a diaper. They took it off. She was terrified and crying. He was pushing her while removing it. He didn't care if she was a child.
I'm just printing off extracts from a disciplinary inquiry into alleged corruption in the Greek border force. At a hearing in 2024, as part of their defence, accused guards talk openly about the use of mercenaries, although they call them boatmen. Pakistanis, Syrians and Afghan, first brought in from around 2020, it's claimed, because COVID and tensions with the Turkish side had made pushbacks more dangerous. One guard says there was information which they'd reported to their superiors that boatmen were going to the woods, raping the women and taking their money. We have been trying for weeks and weeks to get a response from the Greek government about all of this, but we've had nothing official back. So we come to a summit in Brussels to see if we can speak to the Greek Prime Minister. Prime Minister, has Greece been using migrants to do pushbacks in Evros? Prime Minister, why won't the Greek government talk to us? Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis didn't take any questions from reporters that morning, but did come back more than 12 hours later, and we were waiting. We've been investigating allegations that Greek authorities have been using migrants to push back other migrants to Turkey in Evros. Are you aware of these allegations? Will you be looking into them?
I am totally unaware of these allegations, but I would like to make a point. Greece is protecting its borders. It is my obligation. It is my obligation to ensure that the borders of the European Union are protected. I'm going to be unapologetic about these policies, and I would like to inform you that all the members of the European Council, through their conclusions, have made it very, very clear that we will not allow a massive influx of migrants and refugees into the European Union, and we will not repeat the mistakes of 2015.
So are you saying that pushbacks...
Thank you very much.
Sorry, Prime Minister, but these allegations are very serious. Serious violence, mistreatment of people...
The Greek Prime Minister there, Kyriakos Mitsotakis. It is just a couple of minutes to nine after 10 happy days looking up at the skies while the Artemis 2 mission looped humans around the moon for the first time in decades. Maybe casting our gaze heavenward is something that we should continue doing. Dr. Lucy Rogers has written a guide on how to make the most of it. It's called Up, A Scientist's Guide to the Magic Above Us. Lucy, morning.
Good morning.
I think we're good when there's a moon mission or an eclipse or something exciting, but actually we could look up every night and find something worth seeing.
And it's not just in the nighttime, in the daytime as well, particularly now in the spring, where we've got the butterflies, the migrant summer birds coming back. There's a whole load above our heads that we can take joy in.
So how do we do it? How do we look properly to make sure that we're seeing what's there?
Just taking the time to just have a look up, see what's there. I mean, I've seen a couple of rainbows in the last couple of days, which have brought a great smile to my face.
Yeah, that's something, even as a child, you start to love rainbows and it never really goes away. Is there a particularly good place to be? You know, often if it's stargazing, you want to be out in the open areas. But you know, if you're in an urban area, what do you look for?
In the urban areas, there's still an awful lot. I mean, you can see the planets Venus and Jupiter, even from the middle of London. You can see butterflies, you can see birds, you can see bats, you can see a hot air balloon occasionally. There's an awful lot above our heads that, if you take the time to actually have a look, there's beauty out there. The beauty of the sky is it's above us, wherever you are.
I think even the trees at the moment, you know, when you look up at the tall trees and they're just coming into bud, even something as small as that.
Indeed.
It's lovely to look at and enjoy. Dr. Lucy Rogers, thank you so much for talking to us. And remind us, this is all in the guide, isn't it? All these different ways to look and enjoy.
Yes, a whole load of different subjects, from butterflies, bats, hot air balloons, to satellites and